across the UK, online and on DAB.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio. High tensile talk for the nation.
Dial up some dialogue.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
Absolutely wonderful to have your company. Many thanks to the radio icon that is James Whale. And speaking of radio icons, the incomparable Ian Lee is back on Monday at 10. Now, I am Mark Dolan. Thank you so much for having me over the next 3 hours. We've got a lot of work to do. It's exactly 24 hours since the release of that extraordinary exit poll. Even Hugh Edwards looks surprised, and he's usually unflappable. And so it was a thumping majority for the Conservatives. I can't remember an election in which it was safe to go to bed at about midnight or 1 a.m. It was extraordinary, wasn't it? Basically, the election was won straight away. I mean, I honestly felt guilty sitting there watching it. The scale of victory, of course, hasn't been seen since Margaret Thatcher's epic landslide in 1987. Certainly for the Tories, that is. And it was an almost Blairite success story. And here is the question for you at 3 minutes past 10 at night on Talk Radio. Is it actually good? Is this a good thing? Even if you're not a Conservative voter, is it time we just go with this? We go with the flow and realise that hung parliaments are a thing of the past for 5 years and we can actually just do other stuff and get on with our lives. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. My head is still spinning. The Conservatives have become a party of the North. I mean, let me just say that one more time. A party of the North. They held seats in Scotland. Now, I know the SNP absolutely smashed it. Of course they did. But the Tories are number two in Scotland. What's going on? Literally ahead of Labour. They've gained inroads and have a majority of 80 in literally parts of the country that were unimaginable as a Tory hotspot previously. Given that the Tories have about 30 or 35 hardcore nutters in the parliamentary party, that still gives Boris Johnson a real terms majority of 45 or 50. And anyway, the ERG, dare they challenge him at all? Given his personal authority, I mean, surely not since Thatcher has a politician enjoyed such a personal mandate. And I know, obviously, Tony Blair won 3 elections in a row, but it was very much the New Labour project. This is Boris's election and it's his victory, isn't it? It's one man and one man only. And it's Bojo. Can't believe I'm saying these words. It's basically going to be President Johnson. But will it be successful? Can Bojo take this mandate and do great things? Or is this a license to spearhead the most right-wing political project in decades? Now, we are highly interactive here at Talk Radio. We've been covering this extraordinary story, this bombshell of an election for the last 24 hours. Full credit to Julia Hartley Brewer and Mike Graham, who are both obviously pillars of the schedule here at Talk Radio anyhow. First team players, Ronaldo and Maradona, maybe? Basically, everyone is still, you know, because I woke up this morning, I'm like, wait a minute, that was a dream. But the question is, I think we all don't know how it's actually going to play out. I mean, yes, we have the certainty of a majority in Parliament, but what is actually going to happen and what kind of Boris Johnson is going to be running the country? What's your view? What are your instincts? Is it time for us to get together and just get behind the guy and give him a chance? Our phone number is 0344 499 1000. You can tweet at Talk Radio. You can text the word talk and your message to 87222. Texts are 25p plus your standard network rate and worth every penny because you get to communicate with and share your views with the nation. Now, another question that we're going to be asking in the course of the show is what now for the Labour Party? Isn't it strange that as big a story as the Tory success is, similarly, the decimation of Labour? I mean, that in a way, that became, you know, once Boris got his majority, it's like, okay, job done, nothing to see here. I mean, Brexit, that's yesterday's news. It's a done deal. I mean, we would have bitten your hand off for that kind of certainty a couple of weeks ago. But here we are, and the public have decided it. Democracy, it turns out. So in some ways, if you want to get analysing stuff, you have to look at Labour. The delicate ecosystem that is our politics has been thrown into turmoil because the Tories very boldly went north and said, we're going to take red seats. We're going to knock down that now iconic red wall and we're going to turn it blue. And it happened. So what happens to Labour now? Is socialism officially dead? It had its reincarnation, its renaissance under Corbyn 2 years ago, 2017, the election. Lots of excitement. And Labour looked unstoppable. They didn't quite win. But, you know, suddenly the sort of economics of the left were prevailing. But now, obviously, after this catastrophic defeat, do we think Corbynism and in particular socialism is now a thing of the past? Is that it? And can Labour recover? And who should lead them? We're going to go through the runners and riders. And by the way, if they're going to get a leader, Jeremy Corbyn has to resign. I don't know if anyone's told him that yet. Memo to Jeremy, you do need to quit. This is a horror show. You literally, you make Michael Foot look like Winston Churchill. Because the famous 1983 election was a disaster, and they referred to Labour's manifesto as the longest suicide note in history. Well, wait a minute, Jez has topped that. An even worse performance. But he's still in office, and he wants to crack on for the next couple of months, I think. He's talking about into next year when we have to reflect. I think we should reflect on the fact that he won't quit. He has become the Arsene Wenger of British politics. And here at Talk Radio, Mark Dolan is saying, Corbyn out. I think hardly controversial, is it? We'll also be asking, are the Lib Dems over? Because that's another question. Where the centre ground, what's happened? And of course, the SNP and Nicola Sturgeon. If Boris has the Midas touch, so has Sturgeon. Are these two politicians, or Boris and Nicola, that's a marriage made in hell, isn't it? Are they now the most powerful people in Britain? And who is the winner in a battle of those two? So between now and one, we'll grapple with these questions and more. In the company of many luminaries, my senior executive, I'm trying to send the teeth back in. By the way, I've been to the dental hygienist today. And after midnight, when we're a bit done with the politics, we'll get into how great it is going to a dental hygienist. Is that not nice? If I was a billionaire, I'd go every day. I'd have a live-in hygienist. Elton John has someone to do his hair who just travels with him. I would take a lady just to scrape my enamel. But that's for after 12, because we've got work to do. We will be speaking to newly elected Conservative MP Alex Stafford, the first Tory MP in Rother Valley, Yorkshire, for over 100 years. Welcome to the new reality, guys. Defeated Labour parliamentary candidate for Castle Point, Katie Curtis, will be joining us. She's been excoriating about Corbyn and particularly his media cheerleaders like Ash Sarkar and Owen Jones. We'll look at what role the media may have played in the outcome in the election in the company of the doyen of Fleet Street, former Sunday Mirror editor and generally just clever man, Paul Connew. We'll look at not only the future of the Brexit party, but also what is Boris's Brexit going to actually look like, and will it change now that he's got this thumping majority? We'll speak to former Brexit MEP Lance Foreman, who resigned the whip from the Brexit party to support the Tories in December. What a clever move that was. And for elite political analysis, where else would you go than Mike Indian, expert and commentator in all matters politics? But here's my first question for you. And I mean, generally, you know, we just need to reflect on, is this a good thing or not? A given normally in general elections is that you accept the result. And we've obviously, we don't live in an age of compromise. We have the echo chamber of social media in which if you disagree with me, you're the enemy. So how now with a divisive Marmite figure like Boris Johnson, can the country heal? Will it heal? Let's speak to the king of psychology. He's a sir. He's a knight of the realm. So I'd just like you to know I'm on my knees. It's Professor Sir Carrie Cooper, Manchester Business School, University of Manchester. First of all, sir, professor.
Yes, indeed.
We've lost the art, haven't we, of compromise. Do you think there's any hope, given that there was such a divide over Brexit and there was also such a toxic battle between the Tories and Labour fought out on social media, that we can now navigate towards some kind of healing, especially given that we know Boris Johnson will be Prime Minister for the next 5 years, come what may?
Yeah, to be honest with you, Mark, I think the majority that he got is so large that I think people have just, people who want to remain, who didn't like Boris Johnson, will probably just give up now and just say, that's it. You know, that the people have spoken. Irony is, if you take a look at some of the stats that's been done, the big issue wasn't actually in the end Brexit. The big issue was Corbyn.
Yeah.
I mean, what people voted for, when a poll was taken of the people who shifted, the Labour people who had shifted over to vote Conservative, I think it was sort of 43% said they did it because it was they didn't want Corbyn, and only 18% had to do with Brexit. I don't know if that was fairly accurate or how they did the survey or not, but I'll bet you that's accurate because you're hearing that all over the place. So the election was about personalities, strangely enough. Everybody thought it was going to be about Brexit, but I think it was, we just don't want Corbyn as a prime minister, and we're going to vote for the Tories. And that's what ended up happening. So in a way, because the majority is substantial, and because people are actually fed up after 3.5 years, they've had it. They've had the B word now. They're through with Brexit psychologically. Yeah. I think where it could raise its ugly head again. So I think for the time being, perhaps we'll be very lucky and news reports won't all be about Brexit and this nuance about Brexit and the rest of it for at least the next 6 months. But I think it's July 1st that a deal has to be done, a trade deal has to be sorted with the EU. Right.
Well, he's got 11 months basically.
He's got 11 months to do it. But apparently, I think it's July 1st.
Oh, for ratification and all the rest
it's
of it.
Ratification and all that
absolutely.
Kind of stuff. But then he has, it's 11 months. But it's the end of the year.
Yeah.
Right. So I suspect that could start it again. You know what I mean? If he gets no deal, if the Tories get no deal, what happens then? And they then say, well, we're just going to leave without one. Then I think it could rear its ugly head again. But I think we have good 6 months of rest and peace away from the B word.
Well, you know what? I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the B word. So certainly Brexit is, in terms of a democratic event, it's the first, because I've been a politics nerd since the year zero. I'm obsessed. I grew up in the Thatcher years, which was compelling. It was divisive.
Yeah.
It was dramatic, but it was never boring.
No.
But I still remember, however hated Margaret Thatcher was, the public accepted the result each time and just, you know, they basically shrugged their shoulders and went, oh, here we go.
Yeah.
Another 5 years of the Iron Lady. Brexit was a turning point. This was a democratic event in which the public did not accept the result and the defeated did not accept that they lost.
Yeah, it's the first time I think that's happened in a long time.
And I think totally we can probably think that that's because Brexit was very black and white and very binary. But the danger is now, has that created a pattern of psychology for the British people that we don't accept the result? Because if I go on Facebook, and I have many, many dear friends on Facebook, and it gives me a nice overview of, you know, what the sentiment is in my social group. Unfortunately, because I'm a comedian among many other things, Carey, they're all raging lefties.
Yeah.
Okay, nothing wrong with that, of course.
Sure.
But the churlish response to Boris's victory was astounding. I mean, no self-reflection. You know, no comments about the anti-Semitism crisis which dogged the Labour Party. No reference to the fact that Corbyn was just toxic at the doorstep, that, you know, voters just did not like this guy. So I don't know. Are we stuck now with people not accepting a democratic result?
Okay, there are going to be people who say that the Brexit debate is over because he got a majority of 80, right? And the people have actually voted for Brexit, but they didn't actually in reality. So right now, I think they're going to accept it. But you are right. There's a whole sway of people who say it's got nothing to do with Brexit. This was not a vote for Brexit. This was a vote against Corbyn.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think the people who, the Remainers and the people who don't want Brexit, and it's quite substantial. Didn't John Curtis say today that the Remain parties won 52%?
Yeah, correct.
And the Brexit people 48%.
So reverse. Ironic, isn't it?
It's ironic, isn't it? So the point I'm trying to make here is the scenario has been set in a way not necessarily to accept it, and the rationalization for not accepting it could be this wasn't really a Brexit vote. Because if it was a Brexit vote, then probably the Remainers would accept it, given he's got such a large majority, right? But everybody's saying it's all about Corbyn. And if they say it's all about Corbyn, that's the rationale for the people who are Remainers to say, you know what, Brexit's still an issue.
For sure, for sure. But then here's the question, though, as a psychologist, how is it that we are going to heal? Is it in the hands of Boris to bring the nation together, or do we ourselves as citizens need to have a think about how we conduct political discourse, especially when we're on our smartphones?
Do you know, I don't think it's about us anymore. I'll tell you what I actually think. I think that Boris, given the nature of his personality, I think all of us know he has wanted this job. Absolutely,
really?
No question about it. Right?
I don't. Where'd you get that from, Kerry?
Figure that one out.
I think he's been a shrinking violet. He became prime minister purely by accident. I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
So fell into the job.
Let's say, for argument's sake, he wanted this job, right?
Yeah.
He now has the job, and for me, funny enough, I actually think he probably was more of a Remainer underneath. But that's just my own view.
Yeah. But
I think he probably, because he did a speech, didn't he, in 16, where he said it'd be crazy for us to leave the EU. That
yes.
was all over.
He also famously wrote two articles for The Telegraph,
yeah,
one backing Brexit.
So therefore, here's what I think. If he wanted the job a lot, which he did, and I think moved over to the Brexit position as a political vehicle to get the job, I'm not trying to be cynical here. I just think that's probably politically what actually happened. But I think deep down, now he's in it and wants to do, I think he wants to do a good job of it. He's got the personality that I actually think what he's going to end up doing is actually solving the divide. I think his personality is such that he wants to be liked. And I think that desire to be liked and to be seen, because he's an historian in lots of ways as well.
Yeah.
He wants to be seen in the long run as somebody who's healed the divide, that he's been a great prime minister, et cetera, et cetera. And I think given the nature of his personality, funny enough, I think that's what he's going to try to do. So that's where I think the healing could come. If he stays hardline, and I don't think he will, I think psychologically his need to be liked and to actually be perceived as a successful prime minister will drive him in the direction of trying to do things that resolve this issue.
And do you have any truck with this idea that he's a compulsive liar, or would you argue that that's just the nature of politicians?
I just think, to be honest with you, I think they all do. I mean, I think, yeah, forget lie. Let's just say they manipulate the facts, right? I mean,
yeah.
They do what they have to do to try to get elected. They all do it. How many of them are truly, truly honest, 100% honest? I don't think by definition that's not a politician. I mean, it's sad to say that, but that's what I believe. So I don't think it's about that. He had a strong sense of purpose. He wanted to be prime minister. He got the job. Now I think he wants to be a great prime minister, and you can only do that. You can't keep this up. You can only do this by doing things that people ultimately say. And he, in a funny sort of way, he's a likable guy.
Yes,
you know,
for sure.
He is a like. I don't care. I'm not particular. I'm a strong Remainer, right? But that doesn't mean anything. I mean, he's a likable type guy, and he's got humor. He's got good social skills. I just hope that his ambition is to resolve the differences, because they are quite profound.
Yes, and of course, what will happen is that if he does unite the country, bring people together and heal, then he'll be more electorally successful in 5 years' time.
Yeah, but I don't actually think, in a funny sort of way, Mark, that would be the driver for him. I think he's now got the job. He achieved what he wanted to achieve. Even if he only did it for 5 years, I think he'd be quite happy, right? I think what he wants to be is perceived by the public as a great prime minister. He has the opportunity, given the massive divide. Can he do it? How does he do it? I don't know how he does it, but we will find out.
And what about, let's take a little look before we let you go, at the the psychology of failure, Kerry, because the bottom line is that obviously it's easy for the Tories now. They've got 5 years. Whatever they decide to legislate for. It's going to sail through the House of Commons, including our departure from the EU on the 31st of January. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's success is easy, isn't it? It's a very, very sort of indulgent drug to be taking. But what about failure and the psychology of failure and Corbyn, his refusal, for example, to instantly resign, which I think is in many ways evidence of the problem with the guy?
Yeah, I think it is. And it's almost like he's not acknowledging what happened.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with him. And it's about Brexit. And, you know, and it is about him. And, you know, what disturbs me about this whole thing, actually, is I don't blame Corbyn for the loss, in a sense. And the reason I don't is because he has been consistent. He has always been anti-EU. He has always, you know, his position, his kind of extreme left-wing position, you know, let's privatize the utilities and all the rest of it, it's part and parcel of things he's believed in all his career, right? So
right.
He is fairly consistent. I think the danger is, the sadness for the Labour Party is all the people in the Labour Party, 70% of whom were Remainers, and 70% of whom did not believe really in his manifesto, continuing to back him. They're the people who are the losers, in a sort of way. I don't think he's a loser in directly, because he had a sense of purpose. I'm a socialist, I believe in socialism, it means this, that, and the other. My manifesto reflects that. I've never really been for staying in the EU anyway, so I was sitting on the fence and handing it over to the public. That is all pretty consistent in his system, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
He won't perceive himself psychologically as having failed. Actually, who failed in the Labour Party with all those people who went along with him but didn't agree with him?
Do you think there's anything in the idea that someone like Corbyn is one of life's eternal protesters, and that actually it's
absolutely.
His comfort
absolutely.
Zone
and
to
he,
not win?
I think he likes this role. You know, he's back in his comfort zone.
Yeah.
Funny enough, he was a protester with a group of MPs who disagreed with him but allowed him to do it, which was very odd in politics.
Yeah. And
but
what for the Labour Party? I mean, as an organisation and a group of people, which is what any political party are, it's a community. In principle, it's supposed to be a broad church, not for Labour at the moment. How does Labour heal, and how does Labour move forward and regroup, and what kind of personality type needs to be in control of that process?
I think the difficulty here is people went along with him, you know, high profile people in the Labour Party went along with him. I think it would be very difficult for them to take over a leadership position. They're being named as potential leaders, but in a sense they colluded with Jeremy Corbyn in a manifesto they didn't agree with. In Brexit, they didn't agree with. I can't, and everybody knows it. And I just find it, I don't understand how they can have a leader who is one of those people that have been recently named. It's going to be very, very hard. I don't know what's going to happen with the Labour Party. It's quite interesting. There'll be somebody in it, or several people in it, I think, who will emerge, who are unscathed, and maybe even former people who left it.
Right. To come back and pick up the pieces.
And that might be the way they mend it and create the kind of Labour Party that I think the majority of Labour supporters would continue to back in the long run.
Well, just in terms of the broad, you know, your brief as psychologist at Manchester Business School,
yeah.
Obviously we're always told that failure is more educational than success.
Yeah.
And that's when you really learn.
That's when you learn.
That's when you learn. So therefore there could be something very cleansing for Labour about this colossal disaster. And it might just be that out of the ashes rises this phoenix challenge Boris in 5 years' time.
Right. I mean, they went along with the left-wing agenda. They went along with the 1970s agenda, and it failed. And in a sense, they realize that's not where they have to go. And in a way, you know, listen, I'm a Manchester City supporter, right?
Oh, yeah.
We went down two divisions before we learned how we had to. It did help to get a bit of money in, by the way, from Abu Dhabi, but forget that for the time being.
That's fine. Money's money.
Money's money, but you know what I mean. They went down, they regrouped, they thought about what they had to do. And I think that'll happen with the Labour Party. They tried a philosophy that's 40 years old, didn't work, and now they're going to regroup and think about who and what they are. And I think that, you know, all these political parties do grow, and I guess that'll happen with the Lib Dems as well.
Absolutely. Interesting stuff. Well, I hope they're listening. Wise words as ever. Professor Sir Kerry Cooper, thank you so much for your time. Psychologist at Manchester Business School, part of University of Manchester. It's Mark Dolan on Talk Radio. We have the first Conservative MP in Rother Valley in Yorkshire coming up for 100 years. We've also, I'm delighted to say, I've got the media overview. Did Fleet Street swing it for the Conservatives? Ex-editor of the Sunday Mirror, Paul Connew. And after this, top political thinker, Mike Indian. It's Mark Dolan. It's Talk Radio. Don't go anywhere.
The 21st Century Dream Team of dialogue, debate and discourse.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
I've got to say, I'm feeling almost as upbeat as that music. Because, well, I just feel that we've got closure now. Do you know what I mean? I mean, we're talking now about Brexit as just an afterthought. It's a done deal. Right? We know that it's just the terms of our departure. But the bottom line is we are out on the 31st of January 2020. And I'm a Remainer that's always said, let's get on with it. I respect the result. I'm not that happy about it. And in fact, if we'd had a hung parliament, I would have gone again for the whole Remain cause. I would have pushed for a second referendum. But the people have spoken. Boris has a majority of 80. Brexit, here we come. And in many ways, you can just say, right, what kind of Brexit deal is it going to be? What kind of free trade agreement? And will Boris Johnson use the seats that he's got, the power, to do his own thing and his own very special Boris-flavoured Brexit? We will be speaking to Alex Stafford, a brand new Conservative MP for Rother Valley, and the new intake, basically. One of, what would we call these guys? Boris's babes, I suppose. And that's not sexist, because Alex is a man. So I think, for me, everyone's a babe. Do you know what I mean? I mean, talk radio is very, radio, media is quite camp altogether. Everyone's like love and darling and all the rest of it. So I think we can include Alex in that. But let's speak to a man who knows, a man whose job it is to just immerse himself in politics. He lives it, he breathes it, he eats it, he sleeps it. And it's Mike Indian, who is top political analyst for Groucho, Tendency and many other top platforms. How are you, Mike?
I'm very good, thanks, Mark. How are you?
Listen, really well, and great to have you. What I need to know is, where were you for the election? Where did you watch the exit poll?
I was actually doing a bit of TV work, so I was on the Albert and Bank opposite Parliament as the exit poll came in last night.
What, were you sort of on College Green or in Millbank Tower or somewhere important like that?
I wish I'd been inside. I was actually on the Albert Embankment with Al Jazeera doing a bit for them. So
you
I
are
was
such
very
an
cold.
Operator. What did Al Jazeera make of the exit poll?
We were all pretty flabbergasted, actually, when it came through. Nobody was expecting it to be as big as it was, I think. It was genuinely astounding.
Yeah, and we thought, you know, could this be the first exit poll in 30 years that's not accurate? But, of course, it always is. By the way, Mike, before we get into this, why are exit polls more accurate than normal polls?
Basically, it's done a bit more scientifically because it's actually based on representative samples of voting behaviour. So, unlike most polls, when you ask somebody, there was a general election going on, who would you vote for? You're actually asking somebody, who have you actually voted for? And it's 140 polling stations across the country that are taken to be representative of the country as a whole. That data is then fed into a very complicated model, and it then produces, as we've seen the last sort of 5 to 6 elections, a reasonably accurate picture of what the final seat count looks like.
Yes, and could we say that the pollsters more or less got it right, even pre-election, because they had the Tories, you know, to a varying degree, anywhere from 6 to 10 to 12 points ahead of Labour. So can we say that this might be the first election in a long time where the pollsters were more or less right?
The pollsters will be feeling very smug, I think, tonight, because the final tallies of the Conservatives on 44%, Labour on 33%, the Lib Dems dropping away, they actually, you know, they were broadly correct, Mark.
What do you put that down to? Have we suddenly got very honest as a nation, or have their techniques improved?
I think what the things that was missed in 2017 particularly was the uptake in Labour voters. People got caught up in the individual poll results last time round, but actually it's the trends that matter. And this time round we were looking for that sort of increase in uptake as Labour's vote went along. So I think pollsters have also been careful about factoring in, you know, for example, shy Tories is a phenomenon. People saying they might want to vote might not want to vote Conservative, then voting Conservative in the polling booth, which is something that's picked up in the exit poll, but not necessarily in polls that are conducted before polling day.
Now, what's Boris going to do, Mike, with this huge majority? Is he going to be the one nation Tory, perhaps the most left-wing Tory Prime Minister since Edward Heath? Is he going to splash the cash? Because let's be honest, he has a five-year audition with constituencies in the North to prove they were right to vote Conservative. And there's only one way to pass that audition, that's to spend money.
That's right. And he was at pains this morning in both his victory speech and the address outside Downing Street to say to those voters specifically in those Midlands and Northern seats, thank you for supporting me. I won't let you down. But the simple fact is, Mark, we don't yet know what Boris would do. The 59-page Tory manifesto is a very thin prospectus for that government to work on. It's not a Thatcherite government by any means. And we can expect to see, I think, more money for infrastructure, health, the things he's talked about here. But we also have to remember that there's a good deal of the austerity that was pursued under George Osborne and Philip Hammond still baked into the Conservative spending plan. Mm. And don't forget, the Conservatives are still inheriting a large deficit and national debt that has increased over the decade they've been in office as well. They cannot afford to be as profligate as the Labour Party manifesto would have wanted to be. But Boris is also, unlike Theresa May, unlike David Cameron, a populist, and he'll spend where he needs to please the electorate.
What really surprised me was a commitment to not raise income tax or VAT in the course of a whole five-year parliament. Why do you think that offer was made? And because the only conclusion I can make is that the money will come from economic growth. Good luck with that post-Brexit, or borrowing. So why did they tie their hands in that way?
Well, it was a Cameroonian policy, the tax lock it was called. But don't forget, it caused problems for Philip Hammond when he tried to raise national insurance a couple of years ago for the self-employed, a modest tax increase. The only tax change that we know about from the Tory manifesto was the scrapping of planned cuts to corporation tax. But the simple fact is that Boris doesn't want to be raising taxes on people. Now, of course, he's got a full five-year parliament in order to do this, and we don't know what he might do with a majority of 80. But if it's in the manifesto, it's unlikely to happen. There are other ways of taxing people, though. And don't forget, he might look, for example, to say perhaps, close tax reliefs or other forms of that, particularly on businesses. But by keeping those three main taxes low, particularly he's hoping to avoid the pitfall that the coalition government hit in 2010 when it raised VAT to 20%, which hit everybody, but particularly those people on low incomes hardest.
Yeah, for sure. And we know, don't we, that Boris, I suppose, politically, instinctively, when he's not in electioneering mode, is a pretty left-leaning conservative. He was a very liberal, almost bohemian London mayor. So will we see sort of, his mayorship, almost the third term of his mayorship, but just writ large across the nation?
Well, don't forget, when Boris was running London, he was very much leaning into the cosmopolitan, particularly embracing aspects of immigration. But since then, this is the vote leave Boris Johnson. This is the figure who we've seen since 2016 after he left City Hall, someone who's more sceptical about immigration, particularly somebody who wants to challenge development in all parts of the country. What works in London isn't necessarily going to work, for example, in cities like Bishop Auckland, working to Bassetlaw, where the Tories had a 14,000 majority. The simple on-the-nose pledges of vote leave have worked extraordinarily well because they resonate with people, particularly on the patriotic populist right that the Tory party has tried to emulate and has undoubtedly brought them a great deal of success at this election.
I mean, you mentioned that austerity is still baked into the Tory spending plans, particularly given that there's very little actually of promise outside of education and the NHS and perhaps policing. Apart from that, there doesn't seem to be too much ambition in terms of the welfare state. But the question is, you know, how does he deliver for those constituencies in the north where unemployment is high, where the use of food banks is high? There's homelessness, there's deprivation. There is, of course, in-work poverty. How can he deliver for those people?
Yes, and that's quite right. What you rightly picked up on here is that there's nothing in the manifesto about going away from universal credit. The very controversial flagship welfare reform will continue to be rolled out under this government. It's now available in all job centres, and the challenge of migrating existing claimants, many of whom will be in these more deprived areas. The Tories have picked up seats in now. Workington, for example, which is the sort of totemic constituency for this election, has high levels of deprivation, for example. That policy is going to continue. And under George Osborne, the Tories were quite explicit about wanting to see cuts in welfare spending, but a thinner manifesto. And don't forget, we've got a spending review coming up next year as well, with probably Sajid Javid in the Treasury, who is a Thatcherite. We can expect, I think, further saving measures to be found. And with a Tory majority of 80, there's room for any backbench rebellions on these very potentially tricky issues to be quelled.
And who do we think is ripe for promotion? There were a lot of noise today about Michael Gove. Of course, he got to be the warm-up act for Boris when he first addressed the nation. Boris went to his own count, said a few words. Then he made a full statement at 7:30. But Michael Gove almost cut a figure of his number two, which is spectacular, considering the state of their relationship a couple of years ago.
Absolutely. And if you think about the fact that Michael Gove was somebody who was running against Boris Johnson, even, you know, as soon as July, when they were both competing for the Tory party leadership, then,
yeah.
Well, I don't think we're going to see many changes to the government in the initial months. There are a few vacancies around the cabinet table that have to be filled, most notably Nicky Morgan's departure at DCMS means we need a new culture secretary, and Boris has prioritised broadband rollout. So whoever gets that ministry is going to be picking up one of the government's flagship infrastructure projects. However, after the 31st of January deadline and the government had its first budget, there has been a lot of talk going around today that there will be a more wide-ranging reshuffle. The thing is that a lot of these new Conservative MPs, if you think back to the first declaration last night in Blythe Valley, Ian Levy, the new MP up there, has become the face of the election. The first seat that really indicated the Tories were going to win as big as they did. He very much name-checked Boris personally, and you at the start of this item referred to, you know, as with Tony Blair in 1997, a lot of these MPs are going to owe their seats personally, or they're going to feel they owe their seats to Boris himself. So he's going to want to reward them in some way, even if it's just with an unpaid ministerial aide role.
Well, they're going to need a special name, because we've got the ERG, haven't we? We used to have the Gawkward squad, all of whom have disappeared, especially David Gawk, who became an independent and lost to the Tories. But maybe we could call them Red Tories?
Red Tories is a very interesting
label. What they are, isn't it?
I think sort of blondes from Republican might do the same.
Might be a challenge.
Tourism.
Yeah. Tories from the north, but they probably would need some representation, at least at junior minister level, just to send out a message that the Conservatives really are one nation, and you just have to look at the makeup of the government to see that somehow.
What we need to consider is that when Boris came in, he very much brought in the ERG cohort with him to run this government. Now, the fact that he now has a larger parliamentary party to draw on, there are over 100 new Tory MPs there. Their ideological makeup, although they're all bound by this commitment to the Brexit deal, that only really ties their hands in this sense until the 31st of January. What we've got to consider is how are they going to vote, how loyal they're going to be on the numerous votes they're going to be in this parliament, probably on terms for the trade deal, which is going to be the biggest issue the government has to grapple with beyond the end of next year. Boris talked about getting Brexit done, but we don't yet know how those MPs are going to feel. And given the fact that the Tories have picked up several seats in the northeast of England, I'm thinking here about Stockton South, Bishop Auckland, an area that's the only part of the country that's a net exporter and is very reliant on that particular part of the economy. These people are going to have their own views about what the UK future relationship with our trading partner should take on.
Well, of course, get Brexit done. I don't know if you picked up that was the Tory message, but it was definitely mentioned a couple of times, Michael. Clearly, Brexit, that's a deal breaker. Do you think, before we let you go, a couple of quick predictions. We know that we will now leave on the 31st of January. Do you think that Boris will achieve his comprehensive trade deal in 11 months, or do you think we're looking at an extension?
Boris Johnson's continued to defy expectations in bringing back a slightly revised withdrawal agreement. I am deeply sceptical, Mark, about whether or not he can actually achieve this. It's unheard of to agree a what any trade deal that would be of the depth and complexity necessary for the UK economy to thrive after Brexit, particularly, don't forget, as most of our economy is reliant on services and banking. So, no, I don't think Boris has much of a chance of doing that. But he has demonstrated the capacity to pull rabbits out of hats that few of us would have thought. First of all, the withdrawal agreement. Second of all, a majority, the largest since Margaret Thatcher's in 1987.
And also, he's got the political capital, and by the way, 5 years in which to be unpopular for the first couple, by which time everyone's forgotten. So he could probably slap another 12 months on the extension just to get the good deal across the line. Because, of course, he does have to execute Brexit well, because he totally owns Brexit. A, he was the key face of Vote Leave, and B, he's now the Prime Minister that's taking us out. So he's got to get this right, hasn't he?
He does, and don't forget that he basically, the Conservatives owe their entire majority to largely Leave-leaning voters here. Tory Remainers have largely been excluded from this support, but this is a very different Conservative Party to the one Theresa May inherited in 2016, or indeed when Mr Johnson took over the leadership in the summer. The final thing to remember is that the Labour Party tonight is going to really be in a disarray. So for the first time in really this 10 years, we have a government that has a comfortable command of the House of Commons chamber in theory and doesn't have to be looking over its shoulder worrying about either a slim majority, a coalition arrangement, or a competent supply agreement with the DUP.
Well, I could talk to you all night. I haven't had a chance to ask you whether the Lib Dems are dead forever. I could leave with one parting shot, which is, first of all, Labour, can they recover in the next 5 years? And B, give me your top tip for next leader.
The Labour Party's got a long road ahead. This is the worst result they've had. This is 1983, almost times two, because it's a second election defeat. So at this point in time, it's too early to say, but I'm not holding out much hope. I think there's a lot of bloodletting to be done. For me, the three to watch for Labour leader, Angela Rayner, Rebecca Long-Bailey, and probably Emily Thornberry as well.
There you go. There's the man that knows. Get down to Paddy Power. Get your bets on, because Mike Indian, he's never wrong. Top political commentator, the Groucho Tendency, of course. And he is also a rather influential man, a consultant at De Havilland, who are a top political and public affairs organisation. Thank you, Mike. After this, we're going to speak to the first Tory MP in Rother Valley for 100 years. It's Mark Dolan. It's Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
I mean, obviously, I'd love it if we could talk about something else, but there really is just one show in town. And it's the election. Is it just me, or has politics ever been so interesting? Democracy, it's back. Who knows? We might even accept the result of this one. It's Mark Dolan. It's Talk Radio. Ian Lee back in the hot seat on Monday night from 10 with the fabulous Kath. Now, look, I'm very excited about this story, which is all over the place. But the problem is, in the last 24 hours, you know, what is the biggest story? In some ways, it's the collapse of Labour. But let's focus for a second on the success of the Conservatives. And let's look at South Yorkshire, which is a fabulous part of the country. The first Conservative to win Rother Valley in the seat's 101-year history, has said his victory means everywhere is up for grabs. I think the Prime Minister has demonstrated that. The South Yorkshire seat had returned a Labour candidate in every election since it was created in 1918 at the end of the First World War. And that was until Friday morning, of course, when everything changed. A 32-year-old, energetic, thrusting young Alex Stafford won with a majority of 6,000, by the way. That's not even a marginal. That's a solid, solid majority. And Alex Stafford, the Right Honourable Alex Stafford, joins us on the line now. Alex, congratulations.
Hello there. Thank you very much. I'm obviously very thrilled indeed.
A huge achievement on the part of yourself and your team. How much credit are we giving to the Prime Minister and the nature of the campaign he fought?
Well, look, it's been a great positive campaign, and that, I think, really came across on the doorstep. Everyone's really enthused by what Boris was saying and what we were campaigning on. They wanted to get Brexit done. They wanted more police on the streets. They wanted better funding for the NHS. So it was a very positive campaign. But there's also a lot of negativity against Labour. Labour, as you said, has taken these areas for granted. The area I was elected for, I think, had Labour for 101 years. And it was just neglected, and they weren't listening to the people of Rother Valley. And that we saw again and again across many seats, especially in the north of England, that Labour just stopped caring and stopped listening, and the electorate turned against them.
Now, I work on the basis of the honeymoon period, maybe 24, 48 hours, where I'm really nice to you and just say well done. And I'll say that to all of the successful new entrants into the House of Commons. Don't worry, next time I'll give you the full Andrew Neil. But what about you yourself? What was the messaging you focused on alongside Brexit? Because I think there's too much focus on Brexit. And I think a problem that Labour have, if they're going to recover, is that they are using Brexit as an excuse. But it was more than just our departure from the European Union, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Brexit, though, was just symptomatic of the disconnect between Labour in these previous Labour heartlands and the electorate. It was just one example of where people felt their voices and their views had just been ignored and taken for granted. And it was almost the straw that broke the camel's back to show people that Labour are not listening to their electorate.
Now, was there any resistance at first when you started campaigning? Because when did you really sort of hit the streets?
Well, I mean, obviously campaigning and meeting residents and sort of going out for the last year or so. But obviously when there was a snap general election, everyone knew election was coming, but no one knew exactly when it was. So obviously about 6 weeks ago when the election was called, we all put everything into top gear. And in that period, I knocked myself 8,000 doors up and down the constituency, speaking to as many residents as possible. And again, people said, I've never voted Labour. I've always voted Labour. I've never voted Conservative. But for this time, we're going to make a change. We're just sick and tired of Corbyn. We're sick and tired of Labour. We need a fresh start.
How did you go about detoxifying the image of the Conservatives for this population who previously, more or less, would have hated all Tories?
Well, I think that it didn't need to be detoxified because we were saying a message that the residents of Rother Valley were saying themselves about Brexit, about NHS. And when Labour kept coming up with their, frankly, ludicrous spending plans, their over-the-top promises, people just didn't believe it. It was completely uncredible. People believed what the Conservatives were saying. People believed Boris wanted to try and get us out of the European Union. People believed the Conservative spending plans. And by offering people a realistic vision, people got behind that.
Do MPs like yourself, who will be fighting valiantly for your constituents' interests, by the very nature of northern seats, does it mean that you'll push the party closer to the centre ground and further away from any more extreme right-wing instincts?
Well, I don't think the party, Conservative Party, has extreme right-wing instincts, but I think it clearly shows, as Labour pushed to the extreme left, that in order to win, you need to be at the central ground and you need to speak to everyone across all political views. It should be a broad church. I think we did show that at this campaign, whereas Labour attacked the hard left. And, well, the voters gave their response.
For sure. And now, in terms of tangibly what needs to happen, Brexit, that'll be delivered on the 31st of January. That's a good. Does the Prime Minister have your vote for that one?
Oh, absolutely, completely. And all the candidates have signed up and said, we will get us out on the 31st of January. No ifs, no buts.
Now, do you think the Prime Minister, having, you know, been surprised perhaps even if, you know, within his own great hopeful expectations of this massive majority, do you think the flavour of Brexit could be slightly different given the room for manoeuvre he has now within Parliament? Do you think that we might get a softer Brexit, for example?
Well, look, we've got this deal that this deal has been agreed to by 27 of the 28 EU countries. The only EU country that hasn't actually agreed to this deal is the UK government, or UK Parliament, and that is why we all back it. So the deal is the deal. We all agree with it. It's a good deal. We'll get it forward. And then, obviously, in the coming period, we're dealing with the trade negotiations. That is where we can really sort of develop where we want to go as a nation. But the deal is the deal, and we'll get it done on the 31st of January.
Okay, so you will enter Parliament. Are you going down on Monday, or when do you enter the House of Commons?
Well, I'm personally going in on Sunday myself, get my pass, get signed in and all that stuff. But I'm going to be sworn in probably on Tuesday or Wednesday, and then the state opening on Thursday.
Now, of course, the Conservatives, as Labour, have prospective parliamentary candidates in every constituency, almost as a matter of dogged principle. A year ago, you must have just thought you were one of those obscure parliamentary candidates that was more or less sort of making up the numbers, contributing to the local party, and essentially having a bit of a hobby, surely, a year ago. If I told you you'd be going into Parliament on Sunday.
Well, if I knew that a year ago, I would say, well, that's crazy. But I definitely think that we have seen over the last couple of years, and it's not just been over the last sort of 6 weeks, the last couple of years, people up and down sort of North England have turned against Labour. As I said, the Brexit is only symptomatic of that disconnection many of the voters have felt and the distrust many of the voters feel with Labour, people who have ruled their area for over 100 years in some cases. So there's definitely, we could tell it was coming, there was definitely change coming.
For sure. So what do you think, we've mentioned Brexit and we've mentioned the fact that the makeup of some of the northern constituencies might be different to other Tory heartlands. How difficult will it be for the leadership to ride both horses? Because we're looking at, you know, one population that are probably quite keen on a low tax economy. But on the other hand, you've got seats such as yours where there's a lot of social deprivation and you're going to have to splash the cash.
Well, look, fundamentally, things that unite us are far better than the divide does. People will care about their families, they care about society, they care about a strong economy. And it doesn't matter whether they're from the north of England or the south of England. It doesn't matter your difference on fiscal prudence or not. People just want a good economy and to be allowed to live their lives and their views and wishes respected. And that's what this election really was about. People being allowed to live their lives and actually be listened to and carry on as they want.
Excellent stuff. Well, I tell you what, you've still got the energy. You are obviously fresh in the throes of victory. Many congratulations and really good luck representing the entirety of your constituency, Alex, including the people that didn't vote for you. I'm sure you'd echo that thought.
Definitely. Thank you very much indeed.
Great stuff. A new Conservative MP for Robert Valley, first in 100 years. Alex Stafford. After this, we'll be looking at the media's impact on the election and we'll speak to an angry Labour candidate who lost.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
Wonderful to have your company, Mark Dolan, on Talk Radio with you right through till 1 a.m. It's perfect for me. I'm an absolute night owl. It's absolutely the best gig for an insomniac. We've got such a busy couple of hours for you, and I'm afraid it's another hour of election stuff. What are you going to do? I can't help myself. We'll speak to defeated Labour parliamentary candidate for Castle Point, Katie Curtis, who has been excoriating about Corbyn and, more importantly, media cheerleaders of Corbyn like Ash Sarkar and ultimate Uber lefty Owen Jones. We're also going to look at the media side of it. Paul Connew, former Sunday Mirror editor, will help us to look at whether or not Fleet Street made a difference. I don't think so. And what about the Brexit Party? Because today's very much a wake, isn't it? There are winners and losers of this election. The Lib Dems, obviously. Poor old Joe Swinson, by the way. But also Nigel Farage, is he a busted flush? So we'll look at the future of the Brexit Party with former Brexit MEP Lance Foreman. And also we'll look at the fact that, yes, we're talking about Brexit. It's going to happen now. More or less the public have voted for it. And it's an astonishing landslide of 80 seats. Boris's clear manifesto pledge was to get Brexit done. Can't argue with that one. He has his majority. I can't think of a more solid mandate. I mean, in some ways, it was the people's vote, wasn't it? But just by stealth. And we have our answer and we will leave. But what's Brexit going to look like? It's an imponderable. And also, how many people will get behind it? I mean, could the ERG rear their ugly heads again? Now, with a majority of 80, they don't have that much sway, clearly. How many extreme EG are... European Research Group, right? ERG, thank you. Get the words out eventually. There must be 35 of a hardcore. So Boris can more or less ignore those people. But it's very, very interesting to have a look at what kind of Brexit we're going to get. There is some speculation that without the pressure from the hard right of the Tory party, that Boris can have a more trade-friendly Brexit deal, which involves a bit of alignment, because it seems like we have a simple choice in terms of our Brexit outcome, which is we have alignment, which means less independence. So we're closer to the rules that the EU already have, and therefore no friction, no tariffs, or we accept higher friction and possibly even tariffs or paying for market access into the EU, but then the freedom to do what else we like. And of course, that is the tricky choice that has to be made by Boris. That's a political gamble, because of course, what's very good about this result is that we finally have accountability. I think we can agree that Boris Johnson is one of the sort of founder members of the whole Brexit project. He owns it. He was the key figure that joined the Leave campaign, much to David Cameron's irritation. And I think he was decisive. His excellent, I mean, he's good at winning stuff, isn't he? Two mayoral terms, a referendum, and now a landslide, a historic landslide for the Tories. But what's he going to be like in between elections, and what will his Brexit look like? So we'll speak to a former Brexit MEP who obviously wants a bit of a hard Brexit, but will it happen? But what I want to do now is I want to take a look at the media side of it and also the social media side of it, because we've been told, haven't we, for months that Labour were winning the internet. The fact is that if you go on Twitter, which I enjoy to do, or Facebook, Instagram, it was basically, you know, it was all momentum, wasn't it? Momentum, of course, this, you know, socialist organization platform that's, you know, propelled Jeremy Corbyn to power and arguably sent him over the edge of a cliff politically. But momentum has been the powerful engine driving the whole Corbyn project, led by John Landisman. And there were these famous media cheerleaders, particularly Owen Jones, who's got several hundred thousand Twitter followers. And whenever he tweets anything, I mean, he could tweet, "I've just had a curly whirly," and he gets 10,000 likes. And, you know, in the run up to the poll, I'm looking at the social media footprints of Labour and thinking, well, they are winning the internet. But of course, it didn't translate into votes. So a question that we'll be putting to a social media expert later is, does the internet matter? Does social media matter? Or is it fool's gold? Are all of those viral clips, the retweets, the likes, are they pretty much there just to placate the ego of those involved? Do they actually translate into votes? If you look at the Tory strategy, it was basically just saying the same three words over and over again. Boris Johnson riding roughshod over convention by not being interviewed by Andrew Neil and pretty much running a campaign in a very self-interested way. Turns out it worked. 80 seats in terms of a majority. The guy can do what he likes. And it really is interesting that this sort of social media phenomenon, it might just be a paper tiger. I mean, we saw it in America in the presidential elections last time round, when Hillary Clinton was the darling of Twitter, all the celebrities, Beyonce, and I mean, obviously Jay-Z. That's inevitable. That's a given. All of these people were cheerleaders of Hillary Clinton, and it proved to be counterproductive. It proved to be pretty bad for Hillary Clinton, because you've got these rich millionaire entertainers telling poor white Americans who are struggling to make ends meet that they should vote for Hillary Clinton and vote for, you know, another 8 years of the same that they'd had under Obama. And Donald Trump was the change candidate. And my gosh, he made that work. And I think that's something that Boris Johnson achieved, is that whilst he was the prime minister and the incumbent, he still cut the figure of change. He was still the guy that just seemed more dynamic than Jeremy Corbyn, more energetic, more fresh. And he was very clever, because he more or less disowned the last two Tory terms and said, well, I'm a new prime minister and I was mayor for a lot of the first term. And, you know, who cares? The guy walks on water. I mean, he's done it. He wins elections. He's done it again. And his personal mandate is extraordinary. And so the big question is, what's he going to do with it? But the media, We've been told by a lot of Labour spokespeople today that the media campaign against Jeremy Corbyn was decisive. And I'm not buying that. I would agree that I think The Sun destroyed Neil Kinnock in the 80s. And I think the light bulb headline was absolutely, you know, it was just a seminal moment, wasn't it, in political discourse. Was it those that the last person to leave Britain, please switch out the lights? And it had a light bulb, empty light bulb with Neil Kinnock's face in it. Not great. Not a great look. And that was, but I don't think newspapers make a difference now. I really don't. I think maybe that they are influential in the conversation we're having about politics, but I don't think they swing it. I think that if you are saying that the media decided this result, it's more of the post-Brexit telling the public they didn't know what they were voting for when they voted to leave. It's patronizing, it's condescending. The public are so easily led that they just have to look at a newspaper headline and their vote is made for them. It doesn't work like that, especially not in the era of social media where people can access the information that they want to access. But yeah, social media, fool's gold. I mean, did it influence you? Any of those Facebook ads? Did that move you and make you think, you know, or even the photograph, the photos, the very, very sad and appalling photograph of a young child, apparently with pneumonia, on the floor at an NHS hospital. There is some debate about the veracity of that photograph, but it was a moment in the election, wasn't it? But again, not decisive. It got Twitter a frenzy, but it didn't translate into votes. So I'm wondering whether, when there's another election, which, by the way, we can almost guarantee will be in 5 years' time. What a lovely thought that is. Brenda from Bristol, she can go on holiday now. She can completely chill out. But when it happens again, I wonder whether social media won't quite have the cachet, because it just cannot be leveraged into votes from where I'm standing. Doesn't appear to have anyway. I think the most powerful sort of media moment was the Love Actually ad. It was the last Tory election broadcast, and it was just, I mean, it was completely ripped off, of course, from the original film, but it worked, and it was sweet and human and quite funny, quite lighthearted, and it hit the mood. But there you go. Now, I tell you, someone who always hits the mood is ex-editor of the Sunday Mirror, columnist at the New European, so I can't say that he's exactly celebrating tonight. Paul Connew, lovely to have you on Talk Radio. Welcome to the show, sir.
Good evening. How are you?
Listen, really well. I've had the privilege of working with you in the past. Back in the dark days when I was a radio producer, which lasted about 11 minutes, rightly so, before I was struck off, you were a very senior figure. I'd call you a boss, actually.
Long time ago,
but we're both aging beautifully. Now, Paul, first of all, did you see this landslide coming?
No, I didn't. I had quite a good track record until this week, because I predicted that Leave would win the referendum in 2016 when all the polls were suggesting otherwise. I also forecast the last general election would be a hung parliament. This time I predicted on this very station the day before the election that there would be a Tory victory, much to my chagrin, but I predicted it would be between 15 and 25 seats. Yeah. I didn't see this landslide coming.
No, and I mean, we've obviously, you know, looking back in hindsight, it's a great thing, isn't it? But the Tory messaging was very clear, very unambiguous, and it seemed like Labour's habitation of the grey area on many policies, particularly Brexit, did for them.
Yes, it's going to be very interesting. I mean, I'm one of the authors. I'm going to be one of the authors of a book on this election, including the impact of social media, which will be out at the end of January, beginning of February.
Do we have a working title yet, Paul?
Not yet. No, not yet.
But it sounds compelling. Mm.
Yes. Well, yes, perhaps. But in fact, but the problem with it is that at the moment I'm wondering, and academic research might give us an answer eventually, but I'm wondering which was the bigger factor in this election. Was it the simplistic, misleadingly simplistic "Get Brexit Done" slogan from Boris Johnson ad nauseum, or was it the question of how toxic Jeremy Corbyn was, particularly in so many traditional Labour heartland constituencies? Yeah. I think both were factors, but which was the numero uno factor? Fascinating.
Well, it was a perfect storm for Labour and a virtuous circle for Boris Johnson, really, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, simplicity, I think, on this occasion counted. But I think also that the Corbyn factor was always going to be a huge problem for Labour, no matter what they tried. I think Corbyn was, in fact, toxic in so many places. I mean, I did have one little, amid this rather depressing outcome, I did have one little consolation, because I live in St Albans, and I actively helped and supported a very good young Lib Dem candidate, and she won, bucked the trend. She won overturning a 6,000 strong Tory lead with a hard Brexiteer MP, and it went an 18-point swing. So that was actually one of the bright spots of my night, and a rare win for the Lib Dems in terms of coming up to the, you know, just having promised so much, looked so promising before the election campaign began. This was this was one target. St Albans, of course, a strong Remain area, well over 60% in the referendum, and with a hardline Tory Brexiteer MP, so perhaps that was a perfect storm too. But it was, I think, one of the biggest swings, you know, of this election campaign, I'd say about 17 points.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've just had a tweet from Rob who said, the election is over, please stop talking about it, Boris gambled and won. I can't disagree, well, I can disagree about talking about it, because it's just still so fascinating, and I think we're all still gobsmacked at the result. But the bottom line is that Boris did just gamble, and Jeremy Corbyn gambled, and Joe Swinson gambled, all in their different ways. And, you know, that's the nature of politics, isn't it?
Well, Joe Swinson gambled, you know, although, I mean, I'm a lifelong Labour supporter who defected, in fact, over Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, and I'm perhaps hoping I'll be back with Labour, provided they and choose a leader who can reclaim, if you like, the middle ground. But Joe Swinson, I think, blundered, even though I supported the Lib Dems, with the idea of revoking Article 50 without a second referendum. And I know a lot of people who did vote Lib Dem or were thinking about voting Lib Dem who were rather shaken by that, the idea that you didn't have a second referendum, which to my mind would have been the only way to overturn the first.
Do you see, by the way, this election, I'm suggesting that it was the second referendum, the people's vote by stealth, particularly with the decisive result. It does allow us, doesn't it, mentally to move on from Brexit?
I'm not sure that it does. I mean, I don't think this result should do very much to actually heal the bitter divide, both between Leave and Remainers, especially among the young, but I do think that it wasn't the way to resolve Brexit, because a general election is a general election, and although Brexit figured highly, there were other factors too, and I do think that if Labour had had a more realistic manifesto and a more realistic leader than Jeremy Corbyn, this might have been a different story. It won't happen now, it's very unlikely to happen now, but the best way to have resolved, you know, the Brexit issue would have been a second referendum, which at least would be specific rather than a general election. But Boris gambled, and it did pay off. Although the idea is this is sort of Brexit is done, of course, is ludicrous, because this is only stage one of Brexit that's been done. If you like, it's the divorce process has been done, but actually sorting out the finances and the future and the custody of the kids, is still to be resolved, and that's going to be the hard part, and I think Boris's target of sorting all that out by the end of 2020 just isn't realistic. But I'm not, the one bit of optimism I've got about that is that Boris has such a big majority, which it could possibly be a blessing in disguise, in the sense that he's no longer at the mercy, if you like, of the hard Brexiteers from the ERG. And Boris, who I know not too well, but I've known him, you know, to an extent over the years personally, he's not a man, if you like, of great principle. He's a physical.
Can I just fire that understatement of the week?
Quite okay. Yes, you can. But he's a political chameleon, and you know, it's all about his own ambition. So, in some ways, you know, he's not a particularly conviction politician, but he may well feel that his majority is so big that he could get away with, for example, U-turning on that sort of, we must get it done by 2020 and go for an extension, because, you know, the hard Brexiteers don't have the numbers now to actually, you know, cause him the problems that, of course, a problem he had in that short period, you know, after he became the Tory leader, but of course, which haunted, Theresa May and before that David Cameron.
But the thing is, you know, with that 5 years, now you write for the New European, and I guess it's a dilemma for those on the Remain side going forward in terms of how much further to actually invest in this cause, the Remain cause, given that, I mean, if you look at someone like Guy Verhofstadt, Paul, he, of course, is the Brexit coordinator for the European Parliament. And an MEP for Renew Europe. We know Guy Verhofstadt, and he's obviously furious about Brexit. But he tweeted 12 hours ago, Brexit will now happen. The British people have confirmed their referendum decision of 2016. The EU must now focus on building a new, close, fair and lasting partnership with Britain. It's in our common interest. 14,000 likes. I mean, if Guy Verhofstadt is willing to accept Brexit and move on, then surely we all should.
Well, of course, the EU have to accept Brexit, but what they don't have to accept, and this is the issue, is a trade deal that works to Britain's advantage. If you like the Singapore in Europe idea, you know, in which Britain has the best of both worlds. So I think there's some very tricky negotiating ahead, and Boris Johnson may well have to make more concessions to the EU than he's made so far if he is looking for a trade deal. Now, what we don't know, of course, and this is Boris Johnson's dilemma. He's probably been lent, you know, a few million votes from traditional Labour voters, but who have loaned him their votes, if you like, on trial, and he's going to have to try to find a way to juggle trying to keep, if you like, these new Tory supporters, you know.
I think we're calling them Red Tories now.
Well, if you like, call them Red Tories, a good idea. But he's got to try to, how does he keep them happy at the same time, keep the traditional blue Tory support base, in fact, happy? And that's going to require quite a juggling act. And if he doesn't deliver, on his promises, then, although history suggests that a government with this size of majority, you know, won't be beaten, you know, in one term, it'll take two terms, which will be 10 years, then that might, you know, politics are much more volatile. You know, things could change in 5 years' time if those Red Tories discover that they want to go back to being Red Labour supporters or Lib Dems. It's, you know, Boris hasn't got, you know, he's got a solid majority, a very solid majority, but he hasn't got, if you like, total freedom in terms of time. He's going to have to either produce, you know, an effective trade deal, and he's also going to have to go ahead with those with domestic legislation that is going to change or improve the lives of those Labour voters in the North and the Midlands who, as I say, have probably only loaned him their votes and probably went into the ballot box holding their noses when they put their cross next to their Tory candidate.
Well, Paul, you know, you are the wisest man, especially you're one of the luminaries of the Remain community, and I agree with most of what you said, but the whole point is that with that 5 years and those that 80 majority, he's got enough time for things to go. I mean, he can have a year of no deal Brexit before pulling it out of the fire in 5 years time. So he's got time for Brexit to get ugly and then come up smelling of roses, because he will, you know, storyboard all of this based around the next election in 5 years time. And that's a big old playing field he's working with there.
It is. I mean, at one point, of course, the Boris camp were suggesting that they didn't like the Fixed Term Parliament Act would change it. I rather think that one thing they won't be changing is the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which, of course, guarantees, unless something really untoward happens, which it could, but at the moment, I think Boris probably thinks, I've suddenly fallen in love again with the Fixed Term Parliament Act because it guarantees me the residency of Number 10 until 2022.
And also, he's got this headache, which is that he probably wouldn't want...
2024, rather.
If it's 5 years, then he has to have another December election. He probably wouldn't want to do that. So he'd actually have to cut short his term in office, and it might be 4.5 years if he wants to have a summer poll.
Well, as we've seen, you can manage to somehow contrive an election despite the 5-year Fixed Term Parliament Act. But I think that certain other parties, especially the Lib Dems, will be regretting that they really forced this election. I can see why the SNP did. But Labour, of course, eventually went along with it, although some Labour strategists were pleading with Corbyn not to actually agree to a general election and let Boris struggle, you know, with that non-majority, and the problems that would have gone with it. And I think tactically that might have been a smarter move.
Paul, with the short time we have left, I'd love to ask you about Labour and how they rebuild. But we will speak to a prospective parliamentary candidate for the Labour Party who didn't succeed yesterday, and it blames obviously momentum and the Corbynistas. But I think
Labour will actually almost certainly have a woman leader, but which one of the several potential candidates I wouldn't like to forecast.
No, personally, the choice is always a big philosophical question, isn't it? Because if you go for Angela Rayner, then that is an acknowledgement that it's time for Labour to head to the centre ground. If you go Long Bailey, that's basically more Corbynism, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's going to be crucial how much influence Momentum still maintain. And of course, Rebecca Long Bailey, protege of John McDonald, would be their choice. But I think that if they're realistic and want to become an opposition party with potency and genuine ambitions of actually forming a government in the next 5 years' time, let alone 10, then I think they need somebody who is more of a female Blair, if you like. I mean, if you can't replicate Blair, but you can, somebody who actually has that ability to actually capture the middle ground, which of course Jeremy Corbyn failed to do.
It's hard to find the right person, because I think, you know, there's Emily Thornberry, but I mean, you know,
she's
considered the elite sort of Islington sect that Labour is trying to get away from.
Yeah, I mean, there is that risk, although I like Emily Thornberry, if nothing else, she has a great sense of humour and a sharp QC's wit on her feet. And it would certainly, Emily Thornberry versus Boris Johnson would certainly probably be the most entertaining duel of Prime Minister's Question Time.
I think there's only one answer for Labour, and that's Keir Starmer in a dress.
That's a good idea. Although I'm told he hasn't got very good legs, though, so it'd have to be a long skirt.
Oh, I'm sure that's not the case. He seems very well put together to me. But I mean, I don't mean that in a flippant sense. But I think Keir Starmer is probably the most impressive of the shadow cabinet. But at a time in the history of the Labour Party when they are absolutely desperate for a female leader, I don't think he'll get the gig.
No, I like Keir Starmer, but in a sense. You can say, well, why should it be a woman? But I just think Labour do need, you know, never having had a woman leader apart from twice when they've had to have one temporarily in an acting role a short term. But I think, I would think it's almost certain, not a racing certainty, but almost certain the next leader will be a woman. But, you know, I think there are probably six potential candidates, but not at the moment. Going to make a forecast on who it'll be or put a bet on, because no. I think it's going to depend upon how Labour has a very complex, if you like, leadership process and electoral process for choosing a leader. And I think the behind the scenes power play on who is calling the shots in the party, momentum, or if you like, a more moderate flank, you know, who and how the NEC shakes out is going to be crucial here.
How do Labour move on and change when all of the party machinery is controlled by Corbyn and momentum, and in their rush for a female leader they're probably going to get another Corbynite?
That would be the danger. I think Corbyn has to go sooner rather than later, but they probably do need to get Christmas and the new year over, but we've got local elections in which Labour need to recover some ground coming up in May. So I do think they need to have a new leader in place by early spring at the latest.
There you go. Well, a lot of work to do. And meanwhile, Boris Johnson's going to enjoy that big fat majority. Paul, it's been a thrill and an honour to have you.
I wouldn't bet against, as soon as his divorce, I'm not sure his divorce is finalised yet, but I suspect we're going to see the first wedding of a prime minister in office I can't remember if it's ever happened, but certainly it hasn't happened.
We've had babies in office, but we haven't had a wedding. I think you're right. We haven't had nuptials. You see, that's a nice bit of tabloid gossip there. You can take the man out
and
of the Sunday
Mirror.
And we
might even eventually find out just how many children Boris has.
That's never going to happen. We won't know how many hospitals are coming. We won't know how many kids he's got. Those are the laws of politics in 2019. Paul, thanks so much for your time. An absolute treat to have you on the show and to hoover up all of your wisdom and knowledge on that subject. Paul Connew, ex-editor of the Sunday Mirror, columnist at the very readable New European. It's Talk Radio. Next, we're going to be talking about the death of the Brexit Party.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
Absolutely wonderful to have your company. Mark Dolan on Talk Radio right through until 1 a.m. Still reacting, still reeling from the election. I'm still giddy with excitement. I mean, I don't mean that in a sense that I'm happy or sad. In fact, I still haven't worked out if it's good yet or bad. If I go on Facebook and Twitter, I'm supposed to hate Boris Johnson. But, like, he is the Prime Minister of our country, so it's like, don't you just get behind them or something? it's easier with the president. President is the head of state, head of government in America. So not liking the president is sort of like not liking the queen. It's quite a good solution. As our politicians, of course, you know, they are disposable, aren't they? And I don't know how Jo Swinson is feeling tonight. Whether she's up in Scotland in her constituency, I must say that she has a young family. She's an extremely articulate politician, very bright person. I found her impressive. I'm one of the few people that admires Jo Swinson, actually. And I just think that she made a call. You know, politics is gambling. This is what Rob, our tweeter, said earlier, that Boris gambled and won. And I think she just put everything on black. She just assumed that having a strong anti-Brexit position, stop Brexit, revoke Brexit, you know, it was just, it was a clear message. And Boris Johnson also won with a clear message. But obviously their message was, you know, it was ill-judged. But what now, whilst we put to one side the travails of the Liberal Democrats, what now for the future of the Brexit Party and its founder, Nigel Farage? Let's speak to a man who judged the situation beautifully back in December when the world was a very different place. And that was, by the way, last December. Former Brexit Party MEP who resigned the whip to support the Tory Brexit strategy, Lance Foreman. Welcome to the show, sir.
Very good evening to you.
Lovely to have you. And, well, you read your tea leaves very correctly because Boris Johnson is now Prime Minister and Brexit's happening. So well done you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, well, I think, you know, I feel sad in a way, actually, because that Nigel just seems sort of, you know, if you saw his interview late first thing this morning, actually, he looked a bit ghost-like, a bit shocked and disappointed in what had happened. But actually, he should be celebrating right now. You know, he's spent his life, 25 years, working towards Brexit. When he first started, it was a sort of fringe issue. It became mainstream government policy, and it's happening. He should be absolutely overjoyed right now. And, I do feel a little bit sad for him. He can't seem to accept that, you know, maybe because Boris has come back with the sort of glory of the you know, holding the cup, that that he can't share in that joy. But, you know, maybe over the coming days and weeks, he'll be able to, you know, find it in himself to do so.
What do you put that down to, by the way, Farage's historically acrimonious relationship with the Conservative Party, who philosophically are in a very similar place to Nigel Farage?
You know, I don't know what it is. And you know, I can see from his perspective, you know, a little bit of disappointment from the, you know, from not having any gratitude sort of thrown at him from the Conservative Party. If it hadn't been for the Brexit Party early this year, you know, Theresa May might still be Prime Minister, sort of pushing her Remain deal. But actually, you know, the very establishment of the Brexit Party meant the end of May. It meant the beginning of the new Boris Conservative Party. And, you know, it's Boris's sort of magical negotiation late sort of summer and early autumn that brought back a deal. Nobody thought he could do it. You know, the EU have been saying for months that they're not going to change their position at all. And yet, despite that, despite a Remain parliament, despite the Ben Acts, you know, tying his hands behind his back, he bluffed them. He said, I'm not going to sign this deal. I'm going to break the law and so on. And they fell to his bluff and they caved in and they gave us the backstop. And that was absolutely key. Yeah. And yes, I agree. It's not a brilliant deal. You know, we have to say it's not a great deal, but given the situation he was in, it's remarkable that he's actually brought it back. And it's enough of a deal. And if you look at, you know, if you look at all the people that supported Nigel Farage over the years, you know, Aaron Banks, who funded him beforehand, there's a guy called Martin Howe, QC, who was always Nigel's go-to lawyer. Whenever Nigel, you know, there was a legal issue on the deal, he would say, well, listen to what Martin Howe's got to say. Mm-hmm. And even these guys were saying, Nigel, it's good enough. We can move forward with this thing. And, you know, Nigel, I don't know what Nigel was hanging on for, but we're there. Really exciting.
Yeah, and obviously those seats in the north that wanted Brexit, Boris focused on those people, boldly went after the northern vote, and that's what's swept him to power with this enormous majority. Do you think that he can deliver a Brexit that those people crave?
I think so. You know, Boris is a very likable fellow. I've known Boris for a long time, you know, since around the time of the Olympics, actually. I had a sort of personal business issue where my entire business operation was having to be forced out because we were located on where the Olympic Stadium was going to be built, and I had this huge battle with the former mayor, Ken Livingstone, and Boris was standing to be mayor of London at the time. We sort of had a common enemy, and we became chums. I got to know Boris pretty well, and you know, people often say that Boris could have swung both ways, behind Europe, against Europe, and he'd written these two letters. But what I've got to know about Boris is he's actually a very considered person. And he always looks to find the sort of, you know, the costs and the benefits, the pros and the cons. In any deal, he likes to think about it. But once he's made his decision, he's made his decision. And, I've always found him to be, you know, somebody that really, you know, thinks hard before they make a decision rather than just jumping into it.
And I hear what you're saying, and it's really good to get your overview, having known the Prime Minister personally. But there is a tension, isn't there? A lot of those northern seats, a lot of manufacturing, and we know that any trade deal, because the problem is that 31st of January is a sideshow. That's just the withdrawal agreement, the terms of our departure. The big deal, the real, you know, the money shot is going to be this comprehensive trade deal, which he's hoping to, you know, get signed, sealed and delivered within 11 months. The question is, A, can that happen in that time frame? And B, can it be a sufficiently good trade deal that's not going to hurt those constituencies that rely on friction-free trade?
Well, it should be, it really genuinely should be the easiest deal in the world to sign very, very quickly, because there are two aspects to a trade deal. One aspect is to ensure that one recognizes the other side's regulations. So if we were doing a trade deal with Japan, or the EU were doing Japan, they're coming from a very different sort of place. Now, regulations might be different because of sort of cultural differences and so on. But with the EU, we have identical regulations at the moment. They're absolutely identical. So all that time sort of trying to negotiate to make sure they're aligned just disappears out the window, and it could be done literally overnight. The other aspect to regulations is tariffs. And we start at a point where there are no tariffs between either side at all. We could carry on with that. You know, you could really do a trade deal pretty much in an afternoon. It's really not, it's not as complicated as the EU starting from scratch with another country like, you know, Canada or Japan or whatever. The important thing is, whilst we're negotiating this trade deal, we should also be negotiating trade deals simultaneously with other countries around the world. Really important to do it in the USA very quickly, because, you know, if we leave it till April, Donald Trump's going to be sort of caught up in his primaries and so on, and then that, you know, it's out the window there for 6 months. So you really want to move quickly. And also, if you're doing trade deals with lots of countries at the same time, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and so on, the successful, you know, manoeuvres on each one put pressure on the other one, and they help the negotiation. You know, you can say, you know, during one negotiation, oh, look what we're doing with these guys, it's really working, and that sort of puts pressure. So I think what's important is that Boris needs to have a really stronger team of negotiators, and also people that believe in the Brexit vision. One thing that, you know, he's had to date, and certainly, you know, from his predecessor, Theresa May, they never had civil servants that believed in the project. It was always, you know, well, we'll do what we can to sort of keep our heads above water. But Brexit is such a brilliant opportunity for Britain to it's a renaissance for Britain. You know, really fantastic opportunity. What I would like to see is a really great streetwise group of commercial negotiators that can really, you know, turn this around and make this a fantastic opportunity for our country. And the people are with it. I mean, the people just got it. You know, the common sense of the British people, you've got to love them. They just absolutely got it. They realised that this whole Corbyn thing was just, you know, extremist fantasy. And they voted for common sense. And I think it's just wonderful.
Well, absolutely right. And Leo Varadkar, of course, the Irish Taoiseach, has been using almost Trumpian language, talking about a bit of a bumper trade deal with the UK. And let's get on with it. This is a clear mandate for the new Prime Minister. And of course, those are the guys that went off for a bit of a quiet one-on-one stroll for 3 hours, who unlocked this whole thing just a couple of months ago.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a shame they weren't sort of using that same language for the last few years too, but we are where we are.
Yeah, where there's a will, there's a way.
Exactly, and you know what, sometimes you have to go through a bit of pain to get, you know, to get the gain later on. You know, sometimes when things come too easily, the end result isn't that great. You know, our country, you know, we've really had a tough time. But what an incredible democracy we are. You know, if you look at other countries, look at France, they disagree, they go out protesting every week in their gilets jaunes, their yellow vests. In Britain, we have had such an extraordinary argument. And yeah, you can say we've humiliated ourselves in the world, but I think the world has looked on and just looked at the way we've examined the sort of minutiae of every single argument, and the British people have really got involved. We understand our constitution better than we've ever understood it. We know what words like prorogation mean. It's incredible stuff. And
who knows?
I think we'll all be wiser for it.
Maybe a bit like you and the Brexit Party. We you know, in terms of the EU, we called it before the whole project collapsed. Never say never. It's a big question. Before I let you go, in a word, really, Lance. So, are you putting it on record here on National Talk Radio that you think that Boris will get that trade deal done within you know, the time frame of 11 months, or do you think he'll need a couple of years? And will it be any good when he gets it?
I have no doubt he'll get it done. Common sense usually prevails, and you have to look at what's in people's mutual interest. It is in our interest to get it done quickly. It's in the EU's interest to get it done. The EU, you know, what everybody is missing here is that the EU is massively diminished by Britain's exit. We are the same. You know, our economy is the same. It's the equivalent of 19 smaller countries in the EU. Us leaving is like the EU no longer being 28 countries anymore, just being 9 countries in terms of its size equivalent.
Well, you know what? So, you've cheered me up, Lance, and I'm a Remainer, and we Remainers are never cheerful. So I can only cheerful. Thank you for boosting my spirits, and I hope you're right. I think we all hope you're right, Lance. Many thanks to Lance Foreman, former Brexit Party MEP, and now just all things. Well, he's an entrepreneur. He's a man of means. This is Talk Radio. Next up, we'll be speaking to a Labour prospective parliamentary candidate who did not prevail yesterday, and she's going to tell us why.
The 21st Century Dream Team of dialogue, debate and discourse.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
Well, we've covered quite a lot of ground in the last couple of hours. Thank you for your company, Mark Dolan, with you through till 1 a.m. I think after midnight, Sam and Bessie, I think we might chill out a bit, muck around, talk about the fact that my teeth are extra clean because I've been to the hygienist. What a great experience. Can you hear it in my voice? It's better, isn't it? Kind of sparkly. We've talked about the Brexit Party, the Liberal Democrats, the Conservatives, and, of course, Labour. And what we need to do is focus on just what went wrong. The party hierarchy have come out with a clear line that it was Brexit that pretty much did for Labour. But I'm not sure that's the case. And my next guest might agree that there's more to Labour's collapse than meets the eye. And in fact, Katie Curtis, who joins me now, Labour candidate for Castle Point in Essex, with a very respectable 7,500 votes, Katie, but beaten by Rebecca Harris, Conservative. It clearly wasn't all about Brexit, was it?
Absolutely not. And I speak as somebody who is a candidate in a very, very Brexity seat, but still, even there, this was not about Brexit.
No, for sure. And obviously the problem, you know, as somebody that I assume would like to run for Labour at the next election, it'll be a waste of your valuable time and energy and the footfall and the effort of canvassing if Labour doesn't do some proper self-examination and reflect and think about what the problem was. And if you just blame Brexit, then the party won't change because Brexit won't be an issue next time.
Absolutely. As I said yesterday at our count, the people in my constituency and the country over have voted to get Brexit done. So that question really in the short term is out of everybody's hands and is done. So we move on now. So there is no other reason for people not to vote Labour except what was the biggest reason this time.
Because what I'm reading sort of between the lines from John McDonnell on various platforms and also Jeremy Corbyn, who spoke briefly, is that they're saying that more or less the Labour offer was fantastic except for Brexit. They're acknowledging that riding two horses didn't work, but their argument is everyone loved the manifesto. What's your view?
Well, I think people liked bits of the manifesto and probably individual policies, individual parts of the manifesto. I think we see the free personal care for the elderly and disabled was very popular on its own, free school meals for all primary school children, etc. What wasn't popular was when it was all together and looked just like a wish list of things that people would say to me on doorsteps and street stores in my own constituency, but other constituencies that I was campaigning in, that they didn't believe that it was doable.
And it was an insult. It was an insult, I think, to voters' intelligence that you can just find another billion here and another billion there at the drop of a hat.
And that was one of the biggest problems, was we launched a manifesto, one of which I was proud to stand on, was pleased to be championing those policies. And alongside that, we deliver a thing called the Grey Book, which was all of the sums and how we worked out how we were going to pay for this. But then a week later, we announced another policy. But that wasn't originally factored in. So I've now got to explain where that money's coming from. And then a week after that, we have a rail policy of a third off of all commuter tickets, season tickets. Now I've got to explain where that money's coming from. And I didn't know the answer to that. And I suspect I was counting the same money over and over again.
Well, Katie, commiserations, because it must be a very, very soul-destroying, A, for your party to lose, and B, for you to personally not prevail in your constituency. And I credit you as a, you know, an agent of democracy, that you went out there and you knocked on the doors and probably were given short shrift at times. You tweeted today, "I don't want to hear from the likes of Ash Sarkar, Aaron Bastani or Owen Jones," all of whom, by the way, are big sort of Corbynite sort of stars on Twitter, and they pop up on telly as well. "I don't want to hear from them ever again unless it's to say sorry." What did you mean by that?
Well, you say about feeling sorry for me, but it's not sorry to me that I want. It's not an apology to me that I want from these people. It's an apology to the people, the voters, the people in my community who need a Labour government, who need a Labour Party that's ready to get into power, not one that's seen as something that people can't vote for.
Do you
and
see
that's
those people
what I
as
want an apology for?
I hear you. Do you see those people as sort of virtue signalling journalists who are just more or less making themselves famous at the expense of Labour's electability? Is that really the thrust of it?
I think in some instances I would use journalists quite loosely.
Yeah.
They're obviously now Labour activists like myself. They've got a platform to push an agenda. That is true that a lot of us don't have. And they had the power to make changes within the party. Their people, their friends, they're the ones that run the Labour Party.
And they were influential.
They had the power to change
it. Yeah, they were influential and they were proved wrong. And of course, I think that's your point, which I'm very sympathetic to, Katie. Let's hope, for your sake, that you get in next time, wherever you are canvassing and possibly in Essex. Two questions. Who do you need as leader? And are we talking about getting back into the centre ground and new Labour territory?
So, as terms of leader, I haven't decided myself who I think the leader should be. I've been a party member since I was 15 years old, and I always thought one day I'd get up and know who I really would be my dream party leader, and that's yet to happen, and I'm still sort of mulling it over as we speak even. But I think there is a good chance there'll be a nice cohort of candidates who are a clean skin and will have something new to bring to the table. I don't think this is about rehashing Labour, parts of the Labour Party from the past. I don't want Labour 2.0, the same as I didn't want Bennism 2.0 under Corbyn. I think this is our chance now, because we have 5 years before the next election, to do something different, to finally be truly radical.
There you go. And maybe listen to voters. Clearly, that's what you'd like them to have done. Katie, thanks for making the time, especially after what must have been a very long and difficult day for you. It's been good to have your company. Katie Curtis there, formerly prospective parliamentary candidate for Castle Point. It's Mark Dolan. We've got another hour. I think we might muck around next. This is Talk Radio. Don't go anywhere.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
I know it's not a music station, but I think it's worth name-checking that this is a Stoke band called The Struts. Stoke. I mean, by the way, Stoke, that's probably like a Tory heartland now. Yorkshire, Cumbria, they're all Tories. Country's gone blue. Scotland's yellow. We have another hour of this jollity. It's Mark Dolan. Ian Lee back in the hot seat Monday at 10. Penny Smith in the morning getting you up for breakfast. And we do have, courtesy of the World Wide Web, invented by Tim Berners-Lee, the headlines from tomorrow's papers. Daily Express, Boris, I'm dreaming of a reunited kingdom. After stunning election victory, PM sends an uplifting message of goodwill to the nation. I do hope we can move on. I must agree with that sentiment. The Scotsman on Saturday, two landslides, one collision course, a brilliant front page. And it's a head-to-head photo of Boris Johnson staring down the very, very powerful Nicola Sturgeon. And that is a clash of the titans. And then some. The Sun newspaper, Brexcellent. Merry Christmas and then we'll quit the EU. Jubilant PM's message to the nation. The Daily Star reporting on a drama. And of course, this has been quite a potential legal situation. So we won't give you too much detail except to say Caroline Smack is the headline. Flack charged for beating her partner. We don't know the details, but we always wish her well. I think she's fab. Now, The Independent. Corbyn refuses to take rap for Labour disaster. The Daily Telegraph, who must be so happy because their boy, Boris Johnson, he's done good. Tidings of comfort and joy is the headline. Don't know what that means. The Times on Saturday, which, by the way, is it wrong to say this? It's my favourite quality newspaper. It's just...
It's the paper record.
Mark Machado.
That's the one.
You are... By the way, I got your surname pronunciation correct just through luck.
I thought you don't speak Spanish or Portuguese or anything.
No, but yeah. What I did is I said your surname with gusto and commitment.
There you go. That's all you need to do.
You know, if I hadn't had so much coffee and I was phoning it in tonight, I would have just petered out, really.
Yeah.
I
thought it was Mercado.
No.
I did Portuguese and Spanish at uni as well.
Now that is the sound.
But there's a great tradition of Machado writers within the Spanish.
I did a Spanish literature module as well.
Oh my gosh.
Can I be honest with you? If I was in a Soho eatery and someone brought me a pair of Machados, I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't a cocktail.
Or cheese.
Oh, it's it's a goat. We are goat's cheese.
It's a hard goat's cheese.
Very expensive goat's cheese.
I do quite well. Once got paid to taste cheese at the Cheese Awards.
The way, let me give Bessie a name check, because the way it works with radio, you can't have these voices that are dismembered with like no identity. There's just this voice floating around, but no one recognizes that there's. So it is Bessie, who is the senior executive producer of the show.
Yes, I am.
I'd like to thank you for putting together what has been two excellent hours.
Thank you. I was doing it on the train on the way here.
It's amazing what you can do on a train. You produce a radio show.
Yeah, you can do a whole thing.
And you obviously had good 4G signal throughout, otherwise it would have been a rubbish show.
Yeah, it was terrible. The Wi-Fi never works on a train.
No, if you'd
never,
relied
ever
on
trust
the Virgin Trains Wi-Fi.
I don't think those Virgin Trains don't exist anymore, do they?
See, that shows how out of touch I am.
Well, it's only been about 2 weeks, I think.
Is that it?
Yeah.
A Virgin Train's gone.
Virgin Trains are gone.
Oh, they lost the franchise.
Yeah, now they're done.
Gone back to GNER or something?
Something like that.
I think the government, actually. I think the government have... Well, let's not
That's
go there.
That's another thing they nicked from old.
Renationalising. and by the way, so we have Let the Healing Begin, which is in the Times. And of course, this is the big message from the Prime Minister. Let's see if he can do that. Time to start again. Election catastrophe, Daily Mirror. And this actually gives me a chance, Mark, before we do stop talking about politics.
Yeah.
You're the official kind of... You're a bit of a lefty media type, aren't you?
That's my main role at Talk Radio. I'm just wander around day and night representing let's say left of centre. There's other people in this office who are further left than me. But yeah.
Were you a Corbynite? And I'm using that in the past tense for obvious reasons.
Yeah, like I've got no, you know, I've been producing radio shows for since before Jeremy Corbyn was leader, and I remember Jeremy Corbyn used to be one of the easiest MPs to get access to.
Right.
He'd always answer his phone and always up for coming on and talking about whatever you needed him to talk to about.
Because he is, if nothing else, a political nerd himself, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean,
an obsessive. He just lives the job. He's not a drinker or a bon vivant or anything like that. He has never knowingly smiled or laughed at a joke. But
no. Why would you when there's politics to do?
Yeah.
And I was kind of surprised that he was the leader. I think he was probably, you know, probably not as surprised as he would have been. But I kind of was up for kind of getting behind him.
It was nearly like a clerical error when he got the job, yeah, wasn't it?
So ultimately, Mark, what it boils down to...
Apparently he wasn't supposed to be on the ballot sheet or anything, and someone, it was like almost for a laugh, like a drunken bet or something.
Yeah, so we used to keep asking Labour MPs who nominated him, because you have to get, I think it's 27, is it?
Something like that.
Something like that, other MPs to nominate you. And whenever we'd ask the people who nominated him, if they'd regretted nominating him. And I think no one quite explicitly said they did. But I think it was quite obvious that some of them obviously did.
But do you realize?
They were running around trying to get it done in the last, this is what 2015 this would have been.
Yeah, correct.
They were trying to get it all done. It all happened very last minute, and John McDonnell was like begging favors of people to sign the sheet. And yeah, it nearly didn't happen.
Well, you know, Bessie, you're no fan of Boris Johnson, I think that's clear.
What?
Or at least, no, I don't mean that in a political sense. But you're not like, you've never been a particular cheer. I completely forgot that we're not going to let you be political tonight.
I said I'm staying out of it.
And do you know what?
You go straight away, well, you're not a fan.
No, actually. That is exactly right. I completely forgot that we had it, so I won't. But what was good is you didn't argue, you didn't say anything.
I said, what?
Yeah, you ironically gave a politician's answer. But no, what is interesting about the Tories is they are good at choosing leaders that win elections. It's like they don't necessarily have to like the leader, but they do seem to have. I've always thought what Labour are very good at doing is electing somebody that is like the spiritual leader, the philosophical leader, the party.
Yeah, an ideologue.
That they all, you know, agree with fundamentally, values-wise. But it's like what they did with Blair was, we hate the guy, but he'll probably win. And hey presto, he won three elections.
Yeah. So that's a schism at the heart of the Labour Party, right? Anyone who is off the Labour persuasion, you're torn between, do you go out and have a party that exists to win elections, or do you have a party that exists to be an ideology that is something that you think the country should adopt? And at the moment, Jeremy Corbyn has made it an ideology, hasn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's not it's something that in the last 24 hours we've discovered many of the British public will not vote for.
Now, by the way, what we're going to, Bessie, you, when we talk about my teeth, you can join the conversation.
Yes, I've also made a game.
Have you really? Tell me more.
Fill the blank. Mark v. Mark.
Now, this is interesting, because I'm not that great at quizzes. So what's the challenge?
It's not a quiz, but what I've done is I've gone through the statements from various political figures, what they've said, and I've bleeped out very cleverly the word, and I want you to guess what it is they're saying, if you're up for it.
I love it. This is a great,
idea.
It's like a really boring version of
You have to come
tune.
Up with a, with, yeah, it's a very political version it's of good, that. Yeah. Can you come up with a buzzer?
We use the word political, not boring.
Yeah, thank you.
Well,
what's your buzzer sound?
That's a really, really good question. I'm going to, I can probably do it. I can do a klaxon. I can kind of go, like that.
Okay, so you're going,
yeah,
okay.
Is that the Amazon candy?
And Mark?
Can I go tweak?
Tweak. Okay.
Okay, here we go.
And tweak.
I'm struck
yourself.
Okay,
are you ready for the first one,
yeah,
Sam? Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready on the buttons.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, what was Conservative Sajid Javid saying here?
No one needs to worry about...
Mark.
Well, I'm guessing Brexit.
Brexit, no one needs to worry about Brexit. Other Mark?
Oh gosh, I'm going to go something totally left field and say, what would he possibly have been talking about?
Can I take my answer
back? No, you can't.
I think he was saying no one needs to worry about the fact, this was when he was trying to be the leader of the Conservative Party, and he was saying no one needs to worry about me being bald, because he was making the point that we never elect a bald prime minister, and even the fact that Jeremy Corbyn's hair is probably thinning kind of helped.
Yeah.
So he's trying to reassure people about his bald pate.
You think, no, yeah, you don't need to worry about
it. Can I listen to the clip again?
Go on then, Sam.
No one needs to worry about...
Oh gosh, I'm gonna say...
What would you want? I mean, the problem you've got is when someone says, you don't need to worry about this, you're immediately worried.
The problem is, I'm worrying about it and I've become incredibly competitive now. I'm just like, I really want to win
this. Can I give you a
clue?
This was said either to, I think it was today. So this is post-Conservative win.
Ooh, okay. Ooh, so this is topical.
They're all topical. I'm a journalist.
Worry about...
I love how seriously you're both taking it. Spanish Inquisition.
What would people... great line.
What would people be worried about? They would worry...
Christmas. That's it. That's what I'm going to go for.
Christmas.
No one needs to worry about Christmas.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm going to say maybe no one needs to worry that the Tories will shift to the right, given that they now have an unstoppable majority.
That's a lot to fit into that beep, but go for it.
It speaks very quickly. Okay. Let's see.
We've got the original.
No one needs to worry about no deal, because now we have a solid majority, a functioning government.
No deal, guys. Come on.
I've forgotten about no deal.
We'd all forgotten about it.
That is so summer 2019, isn't it? That was the political tune of the summer.
But also, it seems like everyone's got Boris's habit of, like, dispensing with the truth, because the bottom line is that if there isn't a trade agreement within 11 months, there is no deal.
Yeah.
And, of course, you don't have a Remainy parliament to stop it anymore. And I'm amazed that more people aren't talking about no deal. And Boris's chance to really show what a tough guy he is. But, you know.
It would have been a good thing for the Labour Party to talk about over the last 6 weeks, wouldn't it?
100%. Sajid Javid, by the way, who is the Chancellor of the Exchequer. I think there's going to be an interesting reshuffle. And I think Jacob Rees-Mogg will go. And rightly so. Because he's a liability. But there was an awkward moment on the BBC coverage, which I found disappointing.
The only coverage of
the election altogether, okay. It was talk radio all the way. It was the twin media powers of Julia Hartley Brewer, who is no shrinking violet. She comes in firing every day. She shoots from the hip. She says it like it is. She speaks common sense. So she was in from 10, which is really brilliant. So she dealt with the exit poll, which is very exciting. And then Mike Graham did 27 hours of radio, fueled only by red wine.
Yes.
And dark chocolate.
Yeah.
But no, it was really good coverage.
That's his diet, isn't it?
But it was fantastic. And I was weirdly enough performing in East Sussex, and I had a long trip back, and it was all great hearing it on my radio. But on the BBC today, Emily Maitlis, she of the rolled eyes, would you call it that? The eye rolling?
Yeah.
Do you know what an eye roll is?
I can't do one, but I know what
could you
they
describe?
Are.
You can't do one.
I can't. Well,
actually, Bessie, this isn't political, so you can talk to us about eye rolling. Eye rolling, or the rolling of the eyes, it feels contemporary. Would you agree?
I think it's a particular... I think women, we like to eye roll.
Yeah.
I think it says a lot. And
what is it? For those that don't know, what is the eye roll?
What is an eye...
What is it? Yeah, what is it? For those that don't know.
Just...
So, showing disdain with your eyes.
Yeah, it's...
Dictionary Corner.
Thanks. Yeah.
I was just thinking, like, how can I describe it?
That's exactly it.
It's going like, oh my God, but with your eyes.
And it's...
Like, can you get this guy?
Is there an emoji for the eye roll?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I do use that a fair bit.
Well, I think Emily Maitlis invented the eye roll.
It's quite possible that.
And it was some interview a few months ago about Brexit, and she wasn't satisfied with the answer, and she did it. Oh no, she did a side eye.
Side eye's different. Side eye's very similar, but different.
Similar. I think it's worse. It's like an eye roll plus, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an eye roll, but there's a certain level of sort of animosity in a side eye.
Yeah, it's more aggressive.
It's a lot stronger, yeah.
The eye roll is sort of...
The eye roll is, what you like.
Yeah.
Whereas side eye is, you're an idiot.
The eye roll is almost banter, really.
Yeah, I think, it's a bit more frivolous.
So anyway, Miss Eye Roll, Emily Maitlis, had a problem. She came unstuck. Which is that she was talking live over pictures of the Prime Minister coming out of Number 10. And she said, there's the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Sajid Javid. But what she hadn't realised is that she was just talking to a small guy who was basically no hair, a shaven-headed or bald man, who maybe looked a tiny bit Asian. And she's like, oh, there's Sajid Javid. Now, that's a bit awkward, Mark, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
That was everyday prejudice.
That was, yeah. That's, you know, I may.
But I think it was prejudice about bald men, basically. She's like, oh, they all look, there's a bald man, must be Sajid Javid.
Yeah.
I think she's pretty right on. I don't think there was the development of any kind of racial.
No, and she bought Be On Air for what, how many hours?
Yeah,
at
correct.
That point, and she's quite tired.
But it know. Was quite funny to see the ultra uber PC BBC presenter and she of the eye roll say something more or less a bit embarrassing.
Showed her fallibility.
Because it is awkward. It's yeah. an awkward a mistake to make, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a
because
very awkward
Sajid Javid is a Muslim.
Yeah.
And therefore, you could sort of say she's a baldy Muslim guy, must be Sajid Javid.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what she was.
Can you tell someone's way, religion by this?
I've got my producer hat on here, and I'm like, that's not.
No, but I definitely don't think that was the intention. I think that would be like an unkind interpretation, is sort of what. But what was good was while I was saying that, Bessie, you can't see because it's radio, but she gave me a side eye.
I was just saying, be careful.
You did. You threw, you know. She threw shade. Actually,
I threw shade. I did.
There was shade. So, okay, have you got another one for us? I'm enjoying this.
I have tons of them. Are you ready?
Good. Yeah. Go for it.
Let's fit another one in before we have to go. What was John McDonnell? Labour's John McDonnell.
I love
the
John,
only one.
John McDonnell. He's not scary at all.
Scouser saying here.
It's time we had a leader of the Labour Party.
Ooh, now, can
That's
I hear
a
that one more
one.
Time? Yeah.
It's time we had a leader of the Labour Party.
Now, this must be... Well, he's talking about it's time we had a something leader, so you're not allowed to give clues, but was this pre-Jeremy Corbyn, and he's saying it's time we had a good leader of the Labour Party or an authentic leader of the Labour Party?
I've already said these are all fresh.
They are fresh.
These are fresh off the press.
Okay.
I think I know what it is.
Yeah, I think you do.
Is it... I'm going to go with woman.
Okay, Mark.
Yeah, no, now that you say that, because McDonald has been pushing... for a female leader, even a couple of months ago when Jeremy Corbyn was like quite popular, that was the mood music. So yeah, I'll go with Mark, and Mark gets the points, obviously.
Thank
but I'm going to ride on your coattails.
Well, I might be wrong. Who knows? He might have said wombat.
there was a slight W.
The
wasn't
only
there.
Other one it could be is socialist, but that, I don't think there's enough. There's too many syllables in that to fit in the beep.
So you've learnt this time.
Got the hang of it.
Okay, go on. Let's hear it.
It's time we had a woman as a leader of the Labour Party.
Oh,
it's time.
I thought he was going to say it's time we had Sajid Javid as the Labour Party or just anyone that looks a bit like him. But I'm pleased to say that wasn't the case. You've got more of these, haven't you?
I've got a lot more.
Before we go to the break, I want to mention John McDonnell, who I always thought was a better communicator than... You're not allowed to say anything, Bessie, because you're not being political. So I'm just being kind.
You're covering my back.
But, Mark.
Yeah.
John McDonnell, actually, a much better communicator than Jeremy Corbyn. A more strategic politician. More shrewd. Like, cunning like a fox.
He seems to have a lot more energy than Jeremy Corbyn, doesn't he?
By the way, this was always underreported, that Corbyn didn't enjoy the best of health, in my view. Very short of breath, and his rambling, stumbling performances at the dispatch box every Wednesday were, unedifying.
The leadership he's never really worn well, has he? It's always looked to be kind of weighing him down a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I just never thought, he didn't strike me as being that robust picture of health, except maybe in the 2017 election when he definitely rose to the occasion and he'd been appallingly terrible and then the election came and he was great and he smashed it.
He sprung into life, didn't he?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the time of year that happened was that all happened kind of, May, wasn't it? So it was the end of May.
Good time of the year for him. Yeah. A man like that.
And he could get round and it was nice and warm. And
his allotment was in full bloom.
Yeah, he didn't have to do much with the allotment, didn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, his potatoes were ready, his apples were in season.
Yeah, lots
of... By the way, those are all euphemisms.
His potatoes were ready.
Yeah. Please don't let me demonstrate. But can I say something to you, Mark?
Yeah.
Which is... you know John McDonnell.
I do, yes.
And this is why we got you in. We got you in for the,
so I
for,
used
the
to,
for the banter.
I accidentally ended up working for him inadvertently. So my first job in broadcasting was for a little radio station that he ended up running.
LBC.
In West London, in his constituency. And I ended up in a situation where I would literally interview him every day.
No.
Because he was a local MP, and everyone was just like, oh, yeah, it's great that he's doing all this, but he's just a socialist, left-wing socialist.
And a sort of bit of a crank and a bit of a nutter.
Yeah, yeah. And this was around, at the time, Gordon Brown was still Prime Minister, and he was very outspoken about the then Labour government, which he was in essence part of.
Well, he and Jeremy Corbyn more or less disowned the whole New Labour project and voted against almost every government bill forever.
Everything, yeah. He was very outspoken about it.
To their credit, including the Iraq War.
Yeah.
But, all right. And what was your impression of him? A nice guy? Was he
consistent? I was a little bit scared of him, to be honest, until I kind of got to really know him. And then it was just like, actually, he is quite a nice guy. He ruled with a bit of an iron fist, but I think when you run as much stuff as in
what the Labour when they got control of the Labour Party, or did he rule with an iron fist back in the day?
Back in the day,
what was he ruling though? He was just
running the station,
Okay, he was an MP and he ran a radio station.
Yeah, it was a community station, so it wasn't for profit or anything like that. So basically,
this is a story. This is an exclusive.
It's a long-winded story, but him and
radio exclusive.
Him and another bloke who's a really nice guy ended up getting this community radio license and running the station to help young people get into radio. And
how many hours a week did he put into this?
Oh, not a huge amount. He delegated it out to other people and had people.
But was it a vanity project?
No, not at all. I think at one point he even had a show on the station after I'd left.
And when you worked with him back in the day, even in those days, did he have very white hair and then dark black eyebrows like he does now?
Yeah, he's obviously got older because that's what happens with time.
Okay,
and
let me write that down.
He was a lot bigger. Like, as in, he stood taller and he wasn't as, you know, he was a younger man.
Right. But he definitely went for that. Labour love the white hair, very dark eyebrow combo.
Yeah.
It was,
it's a look.
It is a look. Of course, most famously, a look rocked by Alistair Darling.
Yes.
Which is a name, you don't want to be called Alistair Darling, because that, you know.
Imagine, well, he's Scottish, isn't he? So in Scotland, being called Alistair is fine. I went to uni in Scotland, there was loads of people my age called Alistair, and I was like
thinking more about the Darling bit there.
Oh yeah. Well, that's not too bad.
No.
If you can wear that name, and I feel he could.
Well, I think what was good about Alistair Darling, who was, by the way, I think an underrated Chancellor, who was very decisive during the credit crunch. And in his autobiography, he insists that pretty much that rescuing Northern Rock and all that stuff was down to him. And he told Gordon Brown that he'd resign unless Gordon Brown did it. Gordon Brown then did it for fear of the political fallout of his cabinet resigning. And then everyone's like, oh, wasn't Gordon Brown decisive? But
and there's that famous bloop of Gordon Brown accidentally saying, I saved the world, when he talks about that, doesn't he?
That's right. And also the other guy who claims a lot of credit was Mervyn King, Governor of the Bank of England, who's like, well, he just basically lent on the Prime Minister to do this. But you know what? Doesn't matter. It was the right thing to do. But Alistair Darling,
because we'll never know what would have happened if they didn't.
See, I think Alistair Darling probably was not bullied at school, even though his surname was Darling.
Yeah.
I love the way for you, Alistair is more embarrassing than the surname Darling.
I think if I had the surname Darling, I'd get away with it.
Bessie Darling.
Yeah, that would be quite good, wouldn't it? As opposed to your real surname, which is Mitchellmore. I think Alistair Darling, because as a kid, he was called Darling, that's awkward at school, but because he had white hair and very dark eyebrows, that was a bigger story, I think.
Yeah.
I think the kids will be so focused on that. Yeah,
the fact that there's a 8-year-old running around with white hair and dark eyebrows.
Talking about interest rates.
He's really into the interest rate.
So, okay, but this is important, actually. Amid the unnecessary bit, and thank God this is edited, by the way. Can I ask you, so he ruled with an iron fist, but you felt he was more or less a good being.
More or less a good guy. I mean, like, I can't really complain about it. Whenever, he always had a lot of time for everyone as well.
Yeah.
Regardless of how frivolous or, you know, the problem was. Like, I would end up I would get 10 minutes out of him talking about somebody who's written in to complain about, you know, a drain being broken or something.
But
he had time to answer those questions.
I don't want to be unkind, because I think I'm sure that he's a very decent man. And as I've said, I think he has actually some considerable political aptitude. It's just that the main man maybe didn't. I by the way, think Corbyn's greatest failing was just stubbornness. It was just the fact that it took forever. In fact, it never did happen.
I actually think the anti-Semitism thing.
Yeah, for me, that was born out of, I don't think that he is an anti-Semitic man. I just think he's so caught up in his project and a sense of righteousness and so stubborn. He's just not a dynamic human being that could deal with any crisis.
Yeah, it just showed a total lack of leadership. And I think part of that is because he can't fathom racism.
Right.
So he doesn't really understand how to deal with it because it's so detached from who he is. That was always my take on the whole anti-Semitism issue that he's kind of trying to cope with. That he just couldn't, he doesn't understand how people can be a racist, therefore he can't be a racist.
But also, I think when your political views are sort of distilled into an almost sort of messianic sort of passion,
yeah,
then what happens is that any criticism becomes a challenge to your views and your whole world view somehow. Whereas somebody that's less principled is probably more pragmatic. I mean, a really good example, I think Boris Johnson is less principled, but therefore more pragmatic. So, for example, somebody raised anti-Muslim sentiment in the Tory party. What do they call it? Islamophobia.
Islamophobia, yeah.
And he's like, they say, do you apologize for anyone affected? He's like, yeah, I apologize. It's always easy, but he's like, yeah, well, you say I'm sorry.
I've just said I'm sorry.
I've said I'm sorry to a lot of women in my life, so I'm used to the term I'm sorry, love.
Yeah.
but so McDonald, interesting. I could talk about that forever, but we've got other stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
But he's done now, isn't he? Politically, it's over.
No, so I think actually he might be in the shadows a little bit, pulling the strings over what happens in the next leadership election as that comes along.
Watch this space. It's Talk Radio. Have we got more fill in the blanks,
yes,
Bessie?
Yeah, we have. There's a really good one coming up from Joe Swinson.
And we are going to try to steer away from politics before one, so that we can engage Bessie in conversation.
You want to talk about your dental appointment for some reason?
Yeah, we do. And then the fact
you've mentioned that several times.
The fact that your teeth leave a lot to be desired. And
there's a new exclusive for that.
There you go. This is Talk Radio. We've got another 30 minutes of this gold.
Join the Talk Nation.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
We've got the first editions in. I'm still amazed by this. Joe Swinson is not Prime Minister, what? I tell you what's interesting. We're going to skip the politics. We've had two and a half rich hours of it. Plenty more over the weekend here at Talk Radio, of course. But this is my favourite story in today's Mail, which has just come. Senior engineer of the show, Sam, has brought in the papers, and we have a story on page 31 of the Daily Mail, which is, if I'm honest, always the best page of the Daily Mail.
Oh, yeah.
I like to get deep into the paper. Page 37's a corker as well, but we've got this one from one of their journalists. Selfish selfie takers spoiling our galleries, say art buffs. Art lovers have accused the Instagram generation of ruining their enjoyment of leading museums and galleries by taking selfies. Blockbuster exhibitions have become overcrowded in recent years. There have been complaints about crowds blocking artworks and exhibits at the William Blake exhibition at Tate Britain, Tutankhamun's treasures at the Saatchi Gallery, and much, much more. And it is true, the whole selfie thing, Bessie, you're allowed to talk about this.
Well, yeah, of course. I'm a young person.
Is it,
I'm a youth.
Do you know, I'm so old, right, that what used to happen with celebrities is autographs. You're post-autograph, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely part of the selfie generation. I'm not as far gone as my younger sister, who's about 18. I'm not as far gone as that, but I'm definitely the start of that generation.
I share an agent with the great Eddie Izzard. And he used to go around with a Sharpie and just little bits of paper. And he would basically just scribble out his name and just hand it to people because it was so in demand for autographs. But he couldn't get his daily errands done. Like he's trying to go to the post office and send a parcel to America or something. He just wouldn't get there for 5:30 because of all the millions of people going, Eddie, can I?
Well, now selfies, it's less time consuming.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. It's a bit
more
quicker.
Time consuming, surely.
Is it?
But I mean,
because it's like get the phone out, turn it around.
No,
is that all right?
You're right to raise this, Mark Merchants.
Yeah.
Because basically, it's all to do with how good the camera is of the person that has asked for the selfie. You're going to laugh into your shoes now. I occasionally get asked for a selfie. I mean, that's how bad it's got. I get asked occasionally for selfies, and I could be, for example, I could be at a flagship Tesco Express. And I'm just hovering around the meat counter, and someone go, "Oh, are you first of all, I normally have to help everyone with who I am. They're like, do I know you?
Who do you get confused for?
Louis Theroux.
Really? Oh, yeah. I think Matt that. Smith.
God, I'll take
when
Matt
I first
Smith.
Met you, I did think Matt Smith.
Blimey. What, you mean
Doctor.
A man that lives in a building that's a lot bigger than it looks from the outside?
Yes.
He's very good at fighting robots. That's
he's a very good footballer as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's he was going to...
He was in
what
the books at Doncaster or somewhere, wasn't he, at one point?
Good knowledge.
And Leicester.
Was it? Oh, nice.
Listen, I'll
I
take...
I listened to his
I'll
Desert Island Disc.
Oh, is that right? I'll take Matt Smith any day of the week. But basically, what happens is people get drunk and literally, you know, you've just sort of... You were in the Big Brother house for like 11 seconds. That's it. Someone somewhere will ask that person for a selfie because it's just the nature of it. But in art galleries and in other beautiful places, I mean, what's happening now, I'm afraid to say, and I say this with no pleasure, but some sadness, that there are stories of people falling off cliffs and things because they have to get the ultimate selfie. What 10 years ago, it was unnecessary photographs of like amazing views that you'll never, but now everyone's got to be in the photo as well. This is the new thing.
I think I've taken about 3 selfies my whole life. I just don't see the point of them. Also, I just don't like taking photos of myself. I don't see why people need to have photos of themselves all the time. It's like,
I know.
You're going
you
out
know
with
what
someone.
You look like, don't you?
Exactly. You're going out with someone, they're like, oh, can we just get a selfie? It's like, why? Why do you need to take a photo of your food? Why do you need to take a photo of your big old face sitting next to
you? Well, can I be honest with you? I have self-esteem issues, which is why it's really good I'm on the radio. And I have pictures at home of me, but they're all artist impressions.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow.
What kind of artist?
I just commission.
That's a very expensive way to put photos of you in your house.
Yeah, I just get people to do like a really sort of grainy portraits, you know, like pixelated and stuff like that. And it just takes the edge off. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't have anything too photographic. It's not a bad idea, is it?
Yeah. Just get a filter.
I don't
just
know. You are probably too young to remember this, but actually you'd get it if you watch really old films. But there was a series called Murder, She Wrote, which was...
Oh, I love Murder, She Wrote.
Oh, you know that show?
I used to watch it after school because it was on the TV.
Well, it had a great theme tune.
Yeah.
And you would never do this on the radio, but I'm about to, which is I'm going to sing the theme tune. And it
used
to go...
Surely Sam could get us the theme
actually,
tune.
Actually, yeah, Sam, thank you. God bless you, Sam. See,
already
Sam,
on
by
it.
The way, can I say that Sam doesn't speak and yet makes the biggest contribution to the show?
He just spoke just
so
there.
The way.
Yeah, I know. But he's like the other Pet Shop Boys. You've Neil Tennant and the other one that never speaks. Or Penn and Teller. You know the magic guys?
Yeah.
You got the one guy who doesn't say anything. I'm not even sure he does magic. Why is he there?
Or Jay and Silent Bob.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And Marx Brothers, Harpo didn't. Can we ask for your suggestions of famous people in show business that didn't speak? 03444991000 at Talk Radio. Bessie?
The overlooked one.
Yeah, the overlooked one.
The shadow twin, they call them.
Well, it's sometimes like the bass player in the band.
Yeah.
The bass player in the band. Bass players don't get any attention. But
I quite like bass players. Yeah.
Tell me more.
I had an ex-boyfriend that was a bass player.
What is it about a bass player that's alluring, do you think?
I don't know, they're just cool.
Is that the way they hold it?
They're just cool.
Because it looks kind of like it's a bit heavier, doesn't it? Like it's a real...
Yeah, and if you're going to go for someone in a band, you've got to be sensible and go for the bass player because you think no one else is...
What about the drummer? The drummer's obviously going to be the fittest, so he's going to live the longest.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking that far ahead.
I've got maths brain, you see.
So Bessie's very strategic, and she's going for the slight underdog in the band because you know that you can achieve a commitment from someone like that. The Mick Jagger frontman is a waste of time.
Forget about it.
I mean, I remember I had a female friend who's really lovely. It was a few years ago, a pal of mine, and she's like, oh, I'm sort of dating Russell Brand. I'm like, are you? Okay, good luck with that.
He's married and has a baby now.
This was all pre, do you know what I mean? This is when his wild days.
Is this pre-Katy Perry or after
Katy
Perry?
And I'm not a girl.
Or maybe it was Katy Perry.
It was pre-Katy Perry. Because that's when, I think Katy was when Russell started to change. Yeah. But back in the day, he was, you know, he was a bit of a ladies' man.
Bit of a rascal.
Bit of a philanderer.
Philanderer.
But, you know, good luck to him as a single guy. No. But I mean, I'm not a girl. I'm just putting it out there now. The idea of being yet another person's conquest. Do you know what I mean? Just on a list, a notch on the bedpost. Not feeling that. I have to be the
you
one.
You could be a notch on someone's bedpost. You don't know.
His dreaming. So, but how did we get onto? We got onto the selfies. Yeah, but the selfie thing is people. Oh, well done. the last 20 minutes of the show with this.
This takes me back to school days.
The best bit. We'll talk over it because then it's a bit dramatic now. It sort of builds, but then it ends in a really upbeat flurry. And, of course, this was a lazy American rip-off of Agatha Christie. I don't think the Christie estate received a single dime, but thousands of hours of telly. Here we go. Now, the thing about that show is, I mean, it was unwatchable. It was a horror show.
I don't think I've ever watched it.
Of plotting.
Oh, I love it. It was so, to be fair, I loved it when I was like 8.
No, but I think that theme tune puts you in such a good mood. I think you feel good for about 45 minutes after hearing that song, which is exactly the duration of an episode of Murder, She Wrote.
It's accessible, which is underrated these days. What's wrong with something being accessible?
What I'm amazed and delighted about is that Angela Lansbury, who played Jessica Fletcher, who, if you don't know, is basically a busybody sort of old lady, and she's allegedly an author, but she goes on holiday and then there's a murder. I mean, I think, you know, she's probably...
That's kind of how...
She could be America's worst serial killer is what I'm saying.
But that's kind of how all those murder mysteries are, aren't they?
Well, that's so true. Miss Marple, yeah. Right, and also Poirot. But what was... Miss Marple wasn't a detective. You would expect a detective to encounter murder because that's their job, yeah. Right? And hence Poirot. But yeah, Miss Marple would go to like Jamaica and there'd be like mass killings. And then she was in St. Mary Mead, which was her hometown. And
then there's Midsummer, which is obviously the most dangerous place in Britain.
John Nettles has left a trail of destruction. I mean, he's a great actor, but he's killed too many people. Can that guy sleep at night after Bergerac and Midsummer?
Only after murder.
Ironically.
He must sacrifice blood to sleep.
But Murder, She Wrote, and there was a point to this, and it's about the selfies. You see, this thing is not just thrown together. So she plays this, you know, sort of amateur detective. And it was normally she goes with her nephew. She's always got an upstart nephew who's like a lawyer or something. Anyway, we don't have time for this. The bottom line is, Angela Lansbury had it in her contract that every shot of her in a scene had a soft focus on the lens. So if you watch Murder, She Wrote, especially the later series when she was 830 and actually no longer with us, I can say that as a joke because she's still with us and she's a great lady. But basically, if you'd have, everyone would be like in HD and sharp and then we go, no, I didn't do it. I wasn't there. I was nowhere near the swimming pool. And the person goes, I saw you. You came out in your dressing gown and you had the flip-flops. And then she would step in and then there'd be this really fuzzy shot of her. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, she was always sort of like, I just remember in a sort of like golden sort
yes,
of...
A haze.
A haze.
A glittery haze.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with... Do you think I'm making this up, Mark?
No, I don't like... That programme's been on TV for years and I've never seen an episode. I'd watch it. The theme tune. Watch like a couple of minutes of it and then be like, nah, I've got better things to do in life.
Well, there you go. But in a sense, it was almost like Angela Lansbury. She got in there early with the whole selfie culture by having this frosted shot.
Yeah.
Her, which is what people now do.
Reality TV shows as well. Love Island, surely I would if I were on
Inevitably,
Love Island.
Definitely,
her.
A sort of cellulite filter.
Just really good light, just like constantly that golden hour light.
Yes, I, you know, I'm not somebody that, you know, eye candy is not how I would describe myself, Mark.
I don't want to comment on your self-esteem issues.
But one thing about me is I have noticed that I do look my best when backlit.
Who doesn't?
So, is that it? Is that just backlighting? So, for example...
See, Mark, I think the problem is, right, really, I know you a little bit, and I think you are Mr. Charisma, and that actually people shouldn't really judge you on the way you look, because you are, you know, if you're in a room with you, your charisma bubbles through, and that's what people are going to get, and that's what
Mark's
people want.
Mark's getting major side eye right now.
By the way, that's, charisma is not all that bubbles through. I'm in the throes of middle age. Don't judge me. I'm on medication. But backlit is very good, because if I meet people, let's say I'm
Can I just ask, what does backlit actually mean?
It means the light is behind you.
Lit from behind.
Yeah, okay. And it looks better. So, for example, if I am in a shop trying on clothes, and there's like a light behind me, and then I'm the contrast. It all falls into place.
Yeah.
But front lit, it's a disaster.
For fireworks night, I was at a public fireworks display thing, and there was floodlights there, and the person I was with was like, "Oh my god, this is amazing light for photos." She was a photo person.
Yeah.
And then she took photos, and I was like, actually, that is amazing. Now I kind of feel like I
understand
light. See,
that's the selfie thing. So let's say you do your makeup. You make a lot of effort, and you decide, why wouldn't you want to... The thing about the selfie is you're capturing yourself at your best, because you don't look like that most of the time.
Mm.
So that's the... So when I'm old, I can look back and be like, do you know what? On a good day, when I really put some effort in, I was okay.
Well, I've got, after the break, a hack to make you feel young forever. This is Talk Radio. We have only 15 minutes left of this. And then, by the way, at 1 o'clock, Andre Walker, who basically my favourite person. So, you know, strap yourselves in. This is Talk Radio.
Current affairs with Voltage.
Mark Dolan on Talk Radio.
So just to humour me, the on-air team have backlit the studio, and I think you'll agree, Mark Murchison.
Yeah. And, oh my god, you look so hot right now.
Bessie Trotwood, what do you think? I do look better, don't I?
It's dramatic improvement.
Yeah.
Because what it is you see, you've got the light behind you, and it's therefore causing your collective irises to shrink. And I'm achieving this sort of contrast, you know, I've sort of become sort of almost pixelated, blurred.
Yeah, slightly. And it gives you a slight shadow across your face. It's
and
mysterious.
You don't realise it, but I'm moving at a sort of very slow but slightly frenetic speed in order to confuse the image.
I think your
voice has changed slightly as well.
Yes, it has.
It's got a bit slower.
Not going to deny.
A bit more like this.
So it's been lovely to have, first of all, your company listening, and thank you so much for your interaction with the show. And I can tell you that Andre Walker will be shooting from the hip at 1 a.m. He, by the way, is a team captain and star of Fake News, which is a delightfully hilarious weekly topical quiz show, which I have the privilege of presenting on Saturday nights. We took a pause this week because of the election, but we're back next week. I have Bessie and Mark before you go. We're just now, is that any other business? I think we should do another clip.
Okay, this one's my favourite.
Andre,
one.
By the way, hasn't got time for a handover, but all I'm telling you is because he's preparing the show.
Yeah, he's a professional.
But it's going to be Radio Gold 1 till 5. Yeah, and then I'll give you the secret to agelessness. But let's have another clip.
Oh, yeah, here we go. Right, what was Joe Swinson saying here?
Being myself, whether people attacked my vision or my voice, my ideas or my...
What was she saying?
That beat makes it sound like she's saying a really, really bad word, doesn't it? But
I know this.
I don't know. I'm just gonna.
Well,
I have no
you
idea,
think? Mark. You think you've heard it?
It's my skin.
No.
Ooh.
Oh, I shouldn't have said no. I've given it away already.
No, but that's all right. But it's something to do with... Can I hear the clip again? It's something to do with her appearance, I think.
Being myself, whether people attacked my vision or my voice, my ideas or my...
Okay.
Dress.
Dress. Okay, you're going dress.
Is it hair?
Hair. Okay, hair and dress. Shall we see what it was?
Yeah, go for
Being
it.
Being myself, whether people attacked my vision or my voice... My ideas or my earrings.
Oh, yes, the earrings.
Yeah, and she does go on to talk about, you know, smashing the glass ceiling, and, you know, it was a very admirable speech. But, yeah, earrings.
Do you know what's really funny for me personally is that obviously there's a TV behind your head, Mark, and they keep playing that clip of Joe Swinson with subtitles on because it's inside a radio studio.
Yeah.
And I keep seeing the word earring, and I'm like, that's obviously bad subtitling. Like, that's, she didn't say that
you
word.
Had the answer, yes, right.
No, well,
there.
I didn't. No, I didn't think that was the answer. I thought the subtitlers had done a bad job, but it was.
I didn't
like,
factor in the TV screens.
That's actually what
clips.
She said.
That's astonishingly spooky. I feel on a personal level for Jo Swinson, and I also feel for her politically. I actually don't think there was anything wrong with the logic of her strategy. Anybody running for high office should say they want to be prime minister. There's no shame. I mean, you don't want to be defeatist and go, no, it's officially not going to happen. On a purely technical level, it was possible for her to become prime minister. In America, if you said, I'm going to be president, everyone's like, woohoo, good on you.
But
trust me.
They have a different system, though, right? The problem is it's 650 local elections, isn't it? That's what you've got.
I mean, look, it was, I guess in the end, my feeling about Jo Swinson is I think perhaps political experience was lacking and that maybe this gig came 5 years too soon.
I think she had the wrong type of personality for it.
No, listen, do you see, this is the problem.
Because we live in a personality-driven world, right?
But what I love, Jo, so I really like her. I thought she was very down to earth, but yet still a clever person and a astute political operator. It turns out I was obviously wrong.
Yeah.
What do you mean the personality though?
Because we want Boris, regardless of what you think about his politics or whatever, he is a personality, is someone who grabs your attention.
Mm.
And Jo always felt to me like she was fighting for your attention.
Right.
When, even to a degree with Jeremy Corbyn, they probably realised quite early on he didn't have that kind of personality. So yeah. That's how this cult was allowed to build around him.
Well, I think what happened with Jezza was that his selling point was not necessarily his performance or sound bites, but just his values, his integrity. It was like what he was, like the professor of socialism.
And that's how his personality and his public image embodied that.
And
right?
Maybe what we've learned is embodying it doesn't work, because Michael Foot was a fierce intellectual and a highly regarded writer and thinker, but not really. Whereas Neil Kinnock was no great thinker at all, but a dynamic political figure who, yes, didn't beat Margaret Thatcher, but he changed Labour he paved the way for Tony Blair.
Yeah.
There's no question about that, because he made key changes to the structure of Labour before Tony came in, including harnessing and controlling the power of the unions over policy. So, you know, and he made the Labour Party more democratic. But now that was momentarily serious.
Yeah, that was.
Please never do that again.
Sorry.
I'm going to tell you now how eternal youth.
Oh, yes. What's the secret?
All right. So you don't need this at the moment, Bessie, because
not
you're
yet,
in
as my mum keeps reminding me. It will creep up on me.
And Mark, you're young too. And Sam, senior engineer. All, you know, you're like, what?
I'm going to be 34 in about 3 weeks.
But he's bought a new hat to make him look younger.
Can I just say that I deliberately, when you're guessing someone's age, you've got to go 5 years younger than you think they are just to cover yourself.
So I wear lots of hats.
So I said late 20s in case, because I've got a problem, which is, you said you're 34.
I'll be 34 in 2 weeks.
Right, because what will happen to me is, I'd say you look about 32, 33, 34. You look early 30s, but if I say early 30s, then you've got to go, I'm 21. And that's what happens to me all the time.
So now I
go very low.
So I think I grew into my age. So when I was in my early 20s and in my late teens, people would say I was like 25, 26. And then when I caught up with it.
Well, listen, you know what? Really, we should be given more airtime. Can we speak to someone?
Yeah, I'll ask. I'll negotiate.
Just tell Andre. He's got another 20 minutes.
The thing is, I'm not going to get it. Andre, he's the man. So what I will say is, everyone has a window where they just look great in their lives. So I will tell you that supermodels, if you see a picture of like Uma Thurman when she was 12, it's like a freak show. It's like this sort of tall, gangly, eyes popping out the head. What the hell happened? And then she grows into, and then age 25, it's just like, wow, you know. I've got a really good example. Hugh Grant, when he was like 4 weddings, OMG.
Gorgeous.
Hugh Grant now, no thanks. Whereas George Clooney, in his 20s, no thanks. Now, yes please.
ER George Clooney? I think
George Clooney has always been very attractive.
But he's basically, but the trajectory is that the years have been good to Clooney. That I feel like, if you look at a picture of Clooney age 21, Clooney age 50, it's like, it just got better and better. Whereas for me, Hugh Grant, post sort of, you know, Paddington 2, it's been a slippery slope.
What's the secret then? Come on. You're not that long.
I think it's the shape of your face and genetics. And
that's not a secret. That's just the genetic. Are you telling me, Mark, it's just luck? That's your big secret.
It can be, but I just think everybody has. I had an aunt, dear auntie who's no longer with us, and she had such a thunderously angry face. She had a big face. It's a really extra big, just a really large, a lot of volume, a real lot of surface area of face. I'm like, that's just a massive face. And anyway, I'll be honest with you, for years it was not. And then she was like 80 and she was just like the most beautiful old lady. And that big face had shrunk a little bit and it was on the money. It was perfect. So her sweet, she's like, I'm 85 and I am smashing this. But there's other people who look great at 37, but, you know, 41, nothing.
Hence why you should seize the day and take a selfie when you feel good.
You know, an excellent, excellent point. Before I go, the secret to eternal youth, I did promise it. If you're feeling old, then you have to do the following. Let's say you're 40, and I'm 40, that's old. Imagine that you are 50, looking at a photograph of yourself today, and you will say, oh my God, what was I worried about? I was a baby. I would literally cut my arm off to be 40 again. So just always imagine yourself 10 years from now looking at a picture of you today. So it's the same with if you're 60, you're like, oh no, I'm 60, that's old. But when you're 70, you would kill to be 60. And it works forever. So you're like, I'm 80. That's so old. 80's old, right? Not yeah. If you're 90. Yeah. If you're 90, 80, you're a baby. Not bad, is
great
it?
Great tip.
As a member of the media liberal elite, I can happily say that's one of the most media liberal elite things I've ever heard anyone ever say.
I want to thank Mark, Bessie for engineering and putting together a fabulous show that had more or less nothing to do with me.
My pleasure.
Sam for basically helping as a human being as well. If I could hug you, I would, but it would be inappropriate. I'm back at 10, looking after mid-mornings. Andre Walker is next. This is Talk Radio.
This is Talk Radio.